What I need is a complete change. Hillary, I've been thinking seriously of going home.
No. Please don't. If you go, what will happen to my work?
What has my going away to do with your work?
Don't you see, Julie, since you begin looking after him, he's forgotten about me. I've had time for my studies.
But if I go, he'll have another nurse to look after him.
No, if you leave, he won't let me out of his side. I need every minute of the day for my work. I have to stay right here in his library, and his books on his shelves are the great secrets I'm after. Key to the future, it was known only to the ancient astrologists. It's been lost since the burning of the Alexandrian library. And now I'm about to rediscover them. If I'm left alone just a little while longer, I have it. Please stay. You must stay till I find it.
Hillary, you know I'd like to help you, but...
Julie! Julie!
There's Mr. Ingram calling.
This is Bristol. It's World War III, week 10, 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 8th of May 2026, streaming live from the Cumber Centre, close by the Bristol City Centre itself. That is, don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the City of London's UK Empire of Lies. Bristol's only national news show, coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk. But you noticed how everything is focused in London, absolutely everything. There's a little bit in Cardiff, a little bit in Glasgow and Edinburgh, but it's all for England, all in London, the international and the national coverage. Funny that, isn't it? So yes, again, Bristol's only national news show, coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire on Holy Land Radio. That's 87.7 FM, West Sweden, Wisconsin, at Central Time, 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. And also live on the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and the Apple App Store. Easiest place to get the app is via thisweek.org.uk. But you can't get it from the evil Google Play. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except for 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you live the Richie Allen Show. This week, we've got Donald Mack here from Bristol to help us go through the local election results, and some of them anyway. We'll be hearing from Tim Crossland from Save Our Juries, because the barrister that was defending some of the Palestine Action people is now being prosecuted, which is a very, very bizarre turn of events. Obviously, there is a massive intimidation going on by the Israel lobby via the Department for Justice, David Lammy. Have you noticed? And also, we'll be hearing a bit about hantavirus from Dr. David Halpin. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero trust agenda, bending our minds with BBC Verify and boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? Pete Hexeth, ask him. Helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich in Bristol, Britain and around the world, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, but specifically Donald Mack. Hi, Don.
Hey.
It's a little while since we've seen you here.
I think it was the last election, wasn't it?
It was a 2024 general election, yeah, which was where Starmer romped home.
Yes.
Everyone on the whole of the left wing, of course, was just popping corks and really enjoying it. Only thing is, things have turned a little bit sour. So anyway, do you have actually yourself personally any political allegiances?
No.
None at all?
None at all. Never have, never will do.
We don't vote here in Bristol. I think that's the first thing to say. They have all-out elections every 4 or 5 years. I'm not sure how they work it. The local elections, I think, are generally every 5 years. So the point is, there is this sort of myth around, and I'm not sure if it's a myth or if it's real, is that it's not about Labour and Conservative, as it has been since the end of the Second World War, and before, actually, a bit. It's now about Greens versus Reform. What do you make of that? And that is that how that's playing out. We'll have a look in a minute in the local elections.
In the short, I have that as algorithmic nonsense. It's just ridiculous. I heard somewhere this morning that the Greens went down 15 points in 3 days, and they're out of it. They can never win again ever, because this social media football version of politics and news is just it's this that has caused this situation. And the politicians themselves really haven't helped, particularly for the last 14, 16 years. They really haven't helped, and they've played in, you know. And when you govern by focus group, whatever your party, or the whim of their leader, whatever your party, then this is what happens. Everyone is peed off.
Yeah, well, it turns to a bit of a protest vote. So surely it's inevitable that some parties like Reform and Greens are going to turn up on the scene to garner those protest votes.
That's right, and promise you whatever it is you want to hear from the left or from the right, yeah. Promising things that, to me, because of my own ideologies, personal ideologies, to some, from at least one of those parties, I in a conversation earlier today, I actually said, well, there's some things that Reform I agree with. I meant to say Green, and my friend picked up on it, and then, no, there is nothing that Reform represents. It's a racist party with a racist leader that promotes racists. So, as a black person, I would not touch them with a barge pole. However, the Greens, there are many things that they say that I think, that sounds more reasonable, that sounds doable. But there are also things that they say that, you know, Zach Palanty, they created this Dear Leader thing again. It's like a celebrity game show politics nowadays. It's not politics. Zach Palanty versus Nigel Farage, but not in Wales. It's this one versus... This is not... Have you heard about this WWE-fication of American politics, that Trump... There's a documentary coming out about Trump and the WWE.
Who are the WWE?
The Worldwide Wrestling Entertainment.
Yes. WWE. So apparently a lot of the tactics in the United States for winning elections and winning wars are coming from the same sort of tactics that are used the game of, is it wrestling or
wrestling.
Boxing?
Wrestling. Well, no, nowadays it's sports entertainment. Mm. It's not called wrestling anymore. They're not allowed to say that. That's why there are some that say,
Trump, to be fair, wrestling has always been, there's always been that element, you know, the sort of giant haystacks type entertainment.
Right. But what there is, what they developed was these gangs, New World Order or XXX or whatever, but they have these gangs now. And what Trump has created is a gang, and it's a show. And that's the way our politics, and what they sneeze over there, we catch a cold over here. And we're going down through Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage, we're going down exactly the same route, and it's all a game show. So Zach, you know, he's like our Mandani, you know what I mean? They're playing, they know if they can see the game, they're playing the game. Gavin Newsom, they play the game. But it's not real. And we live in the real world, and people, some people can see through it, some people say, but at least he says things that I like, so I'll vote for him, because isn't this a celebrity show? Isn't this, what's the show that Trump came from? The Apprentice. You know, it's The Apprentice meets the WWE. It's all a game.
Actually, quite a lot of the world leaders, including our wonderful Zelensky, came from the media world. Look, before we hear from Martin, I'd just like to pick up on what you're saying about Polanski, because I noticed that Double Down News this week, they've started a new series. Well, they call it Double Down News Watch, which I think sounds awful, but let's just change what they said and call it News Watch, because it's looking at the coverage in the run-up to these local elections of Zach Polanski, and particularly the way he dealt with the attacks in Golders Green last week.
Well, he's obviously made, you know, this time last year most people never heard who he was, so he's obviously made a splash in terms of being recognised. And I suppose in some senses, even when he's made mistakes, it means that he's still in the news. So, I mean, I suppose they will be reasonably happy with what
they've
done.
I think, an attempt to really, from the BBC particularly, to have a go at Polanski and at Nigel Farage, almost as if, well, to say, well, a warning against voting for these fringe parties. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the Double Down News report.
Last week, the Jewish community of Golders Green in northwest London was traumatised by the horrific stabbing of two men. It quickly became clear the assailant was mentally ill. He'd earlier attacked a non-Jewish man in south London. All three victims survived. There was little to suggest the attacker was part of any broader terrorist or political group. But coming in the wake of a series of attacks on Jewish property, the stabbings were given wall-to-wall coverage by UK media. The existence of the non-Jewish victim effectively erased in much of the reporting, and even by the police, who announced he'd been charged following the stabbing of two men rather than three. The incident prompted a chorus of demands from across the political spectrum for a crackdown on demonstrations against the genocide in Gaza, termed hate marches, including from Reform Party leader Nigel Farage.
I'm afraid we have allowed marches to take place, with chants being heard over the streets of London and other cities, and we've not acted, and the government has been weak, weak, weak on all of this.
Farage, of course, was recently exposed as having been, at least in his youth, a crude and extreme anti-Semite. Just in case Jewish people weren't terrified enough, on Sunday, Trevor Phillips launched an extraordinary monologue at the start of his show on Sky.
There are people in this nation right now hunting Jews for no other reason than that they are Jews. Everything else is just a way of justifying their persecution. There's a grim guessing game being played out in some Jewish households, I'm told. The family debates who among their Gentile friends would have protected them from persecution a century ago, and who would have turned their backs for fear of being ostracized themselves. The question being asked is, would they hide me?
Phillips went on to pressure his guests to call for restrictions on anti-genocide protests.
So, yeah, his guests are saying that maybe we should restrict the anti-genocide protests. And I quite like the way that Richard Sanders at Double Down News puts this, but he's explaining a few things there. He's pointing the finger directly at the police and saying, well, the police actually lied about what happened last week in Golders Green. So they're saying that there were two stabbings. There weren't. There were three stabbings, all by the same guy. One of a Muslim, the two of Jewish people. But he's also making a larger point there. Trevor Phillips is creating this sort of narrative here that that Jewish people around the dinner table are now saying we're being betrayed by those around us, and they wouldn't hide us right now if the Nazis were to come knocking on the door.
Well, I mean, it's a witch's brew of nasty. You know, it's stirring up hatred where we shouldn't be doing this. We should actually be coming together as a community when these things happen. Everybody should be clear why we don't approve of what's going on, and it shouldn't be politicised in the way that they've done. And, of course, it's very interesting that this guy clearly didn't have any political motivation. He'd been released from psychiatric care 6 days before. So for them all to jump on, and of course Nigel Farage jumped in after the ambulance events, saying we've got to ban the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, as if they had anything to do with it. And of course the whole media stir around all of this is because there's an Iranian-backed terror group operating in Europe. And we covered this previous weeks.
I think
this so-called Iranian-backed terror group is quite straightforwardly an Israeli psychological warfare operation.
Can I just say?
Which means, of course, that the attacks on Jewish community centres and stuff around Europe have been carried out probably by the Israeli intelligence services. They're the ones who should be in the dock.
Well, look, I mean, this so-called Iranian terror group is basically an internet entity.
Seems
to me almost like basing your news story on some kind of chatbot that's automatically generated, but actually this has been rather badly generated because the language is all wrong in the propaganda that that they're supposed to be. Anyway, Don, there's another aspect to all of this, and that is the I mean, it's come out since that, to add to Richard Sanders is saying there, there was an Iranian guy stabbed the previous week in central London, which had got absolutely no reporting whatsoever at a demonstration by another Iranian who was anti his government. He was doing a demo for pro-Iran demo, an anti-Trump demo, and he was stabbed, hospitalised. There was no reporting. In fact, I looked very carefully for this guy. There was only one article, and that is in your beloved Evening Standard, just reporting that the guy had been taken to court. No reporting whatsoever. And also that the alleged perpetrator of the two stabbings of the Jewish guys in Golders Green had been in jail for stabbing a policeman as well in the past. None of this was really talked about in the two or three days of media hysteria around it. So anyway, and then of course to add insult to injury, if you want, or really, you suddenly got Zach Polanski saying, "Oh, the police were over the top kicking him because they were trying to get him to release a knife. He was hiding the knife." Yeah. Zach had obviously seen the footage, but he didn't realise the guy was hiding a knife underneath him. Yeah. And so, yeah, this was really the idea. Seems to be to sort of have a big go at Zach Polanski just before the local election.
Yes, it was. It's absolutely, and he kind of fell into trap. I'm gonna say this though. I saw the film, the same film that Zach saw, and I thought, oh my God, they're kicking the guy in the head and he's on the ground. That's a natural reaction. Especially, maybe I'm not a politician, maybe Zach thought he was having his George Floyd moment. He was going to be the first one on it. The fact that the guy had a knife and had already been tasered and was on the ground, do you actually need to kick the guy in the head? I don't know. I don't know, because he's got a knife and people's, you know, are in danger. I wasn't there. I have not watched the full footage from the various angles. But my reaction was the same as Zach's. It's like, do you really have to kick the guy on the head? Stand on his arm? You know, it's like in America, or I'm Jamaicans, they shoot in Jamaica, they shoot to kill the police. You know, can you shoot him in the leg? Maybe. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of leg. There's half of their body. Shoot them in the leg, that bring them down. But they just go for the chest and the head. The way to subdue someone isn't necessarily by kicking them in the head while they're on the ground. However, under the circumstances, you do want to stop the person as quickly and easily, you know, quickly as possible. But I don't know. My natural first reaction was, and yes, you're right. I think Zach jumped on it, kind of misread the situation a little bit, and they went for him, because remember, they can't go for him unless they're going to call him a self-hating Jew. So you know, he gave them the weaponry. He's young. They are a young party, and then you know, it's one of those things to say, well, they're not really ready yet, but. Did he really expect the reform to win the next general election? Are you crazy?
I don't think
reform or the Greens, actually.
Reform may well win the next general election. If you look at the polls, they may get a working majority. Yeah, they may. I mean, things may well change, and particularly since Farage is slowly emerging as the person that he is. Anyway, look, let's have a listen now to Polanski, he had this to say today. He thinks that the Greens have done rather well in the local elections. Just to remind people, Bristol is controlled by the Green Party, and maybe we can have a little discussion after we've heard from Zach about how for the last couple of years our guests think that the Greens have been doing here in Bristol.
This is the first time the Green Party have ever won a directly elected mayor. And two-party politics is not just dying, it is dead and it is buried. And actually, whether it's here that Labour have been rejected or whether we're seeing around the country, it's very clear that the new politics is the Green Party versus Reform. I said that the Green Party were going to replace Labour. That's exactly what we did in Gorton and Denton. It's what we've done in Hackney, and we're seeing that right across the country. In fact, in almost all of our seats right across the country, whether they're target or non-target, the Green Party vote share is rising.
It's a good result for you here. Labour haven't done quite as disastrously so far as many were expecting. Does that mean that you're not quite as popular as you thought?
I think the Labour Party have done a good job of expectation management, and actually the fact they've had a terrible result rather than an existentially bad result, I don't think is particularly good for them. But I'm not interested in just criticising the government. What Zoe has done in Hackney, and we're seeing right across the country, is the Green Party are offering a tangible plan for change alongside hope. That's such a powerful combination. And what I see all across the country are people saying they're feeling hopeful for politics for the first time. Some people, yes, were disillusioned with Labour and are now voting for the Green Party. But lots of people are voting for the Green Party for the very first time who didn't vote before. And that's really exciting.
In many places, your biggest contribution might be splitting the progressive vote, paving the way for reform. Are you comfortable with that?
I would reject the idea that the Labour Party are a progressive vote. The Labour Party, since they got into office, have continued austerity. They tried to cut disability benefits. We had more children going into poverty for far too long. They brought Peter Mandelson into the heart of government, and we've seen an ongoing genocide in Gaza. So the idea that this Labour government offers any kind of progressive politics, I think, is for the birds. And actually, anyone who's on the left in politics, progressive progressive, or even just wants a politics of common sense, where we're redistributing power and wealth away from multimillionaires and billionaires and putting it back into our communities. That's a vote for the Green Party. And what I'd say to anyone is, we need your help, and today is a brilliant day to join the Green Party.
Okay, strip away the label progressive. You might be splitting the left vote and paving the way for reform. Are you comfortable with that?
I still reject the idea that the Labour Party are in any way a left-wing party. Keir Starmer was a man who echoed the words of Enoch Powell. We've seen in Shabana Mahmood increasingly anti-migrant rhetoric, and as I've said, we've had the ongoing genocide. I think a left-wing government, or anyone who wants to change anything in this country, would look at how much communities are suffering right now, and they would work to end rip-off Britain. We have this toxic combination of low wages and high bills, and it feels like the Labour government haven't done anything to get a grip of that. The first thing they should be doing, for instance, is freezing energy bills. It's outrageous that we've got this illegal and unpopular war, and there are people working two or three jobs who are going to be having to pay even more for their energy bills that they just can't afford right now. We need to make sure we have elected Greens in office who actually look out for people who are working so hard and aren't being rewarded for how hard they're working.
So that's Zach Polanski speaking a little earlier today, doing rather well, the Greens. Anyway, do you want to just comment on that? John, you were laughing through there quite a bit. But, I mean, the thing is, for a lot of these, it's about what your priorities are. He's there saying, look, the priority should be the economy, should be making sure people can pay the bills, and it should be anti-war.
Yeah, these were local elections, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he's pushing it for a national issue, isn't he?
Well, so are reform. They've made it tried to make it a national.
And they're talking about immigration.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, for me,
which is not on any of the paraphernalia for what the powers that these people would get if they were elected.
Absolutely, quite true. But I mean, people do vote, as you know. For example, the collapse in the Labour vote. Let's just look at what it's been looking like. This is on right now because the votes are still being counted.
Is this pre or post expectation management?
this is reality biting them on the bottom.
Yeah, there you go.
So this is at 25 past five on the day after the local election. So the Labour Party has lost 780, a colossal, really massive total of their local council seats, whilst Reform has gained 1,017. So the next worst is the Conservatives. They've lost about 450 in the local elections, 450 councillors. The Lib Dems have added 61, which isn't a big change. The Greens have added about three times that, which is that's 180 local councillors. So these are the rough changes. And Reform are right in the lead now with the highest number of local councillors, 1,025. The next nearest to them are the Lib Dems with half of that, and Labour and Conservative roughly with about 500 each. The big changes, well, let's just talk about those to begin with, because that is a massive, massive swing to Reform. This is what I mean about Starmer. You see, this is the Starmer effect. People just don't like Starmer, and they don't care about the local council. But if they see a national leader of a party they don't like, then they're just leaving the Labour Party in their droves.
Just to go back to the Gold is Green thing, I mean, they booed the MP who's Jewish, they booed the Prime Minister who's married to a Jewish person and has done as much as a prime minister can do. I honestly believe that the United Kingdom has been gaslit into hate in Keir Starmer. I don't think it's particularly great, but again, it goes back to this celebrity show that we've had with Boris and Liz and Rishi. You know, he's boring and he's detailed and he messes up and he's not very good. He hasn't been in Parliament that long. He's not that experienced. 2 years, wasn't it, I think, before he became leader? He was in Parliament. He's relatively recent, a politician. He's not one of those 20-yearers, you know.
You could call him a Mandelsonian.
Because
Mandelson, for about the last decade, has been very involved in selecting the new MPs.
Mm. And the different cliques and groups within the party and the factions that have manoeuvred him into that place, because that's exactly what happened to get Jezza. Jeremy
Corbyn.
So
is this the press, do you think? Or is it the fact that the guy just doesn't have personality?
Do you remember 16 pages of Currygate in the Daily Mail? Do you remember Currygate?
Edwina?
No. Him and Angela having a curry on the campaign trail.
Breaking the
16 pages in the Daily Mail. You know, and it went on and on and on. How much did the glasses cost or his white dresses cost? Farage got 5 million.
Do Labour voters really read the Daily Mail?
No, but it does. The newspapers, and this is weird, because although the newspaper sales has gone down, people still pay attention to the newspapers on the radio.
Yeah.
Newsnight. And before we go, we'll just have a look at the headlines of the papers, of selected newspaper headlines. And the headline is not a story. It really isn't. It's a headline to grab your attention.
That's right, to sell the paper.
But it frames... It starts to frame the debate. And they're all... So newspapers are still able, in some ways, to push and frame the debate, even though, people don't read them, people don't buy them.
The thing is, though, with Starmer, is there's no substitute for personality. And he doesn't have a personality.
No, but you know what? Personally, I don't need my Prime Minister. The Prime Minister is supposed to be first amongst equals. He's not supposed to be the dear leader, right? He's the first amongst equals. I'm for... Government. I mean, I had this discussion earlier today about what the hell is a democracy? You know, a democratic cabinet with democratic, secretaries of state or whatever you call them, whichever country you're in, cabinet secretaries and ministers and all of that, they have power. And they should have power. It shouldn't all be... Everything Labour does, they sneeze. Starmer did this. Someone got sick in the Isle of Sheppey. I'm waiting to hear, how is it Starmer's fault? That's what it's been like since they've been...
Well, hang on, because you've also got people like David Lammy. I think a lot of the cabinet, the Labour cabinet, are Mandelsonians. So these are people that are selected by a certain neoconservative clique that wants the Labour Party just simply to forward the City of London style policies, not traditional Labour. In fact, Starmer was elected on this platform of, I'm a traditional Labour chappy. But, actual policies have been very difficult to distinguish from the overall policies of other countries in Europe. He's someone that follows a sort of city investor.
Focus group mixed with a bit of technocrats.
The real question here is, will the Labour Party act to do something about... Because Starmer's clearly... this is an enormous collapse, really. 800 councillors gone, plus over 1,000 for reform.
I think the short answer is probably no, because there's no...
Martin?
There's no one,
Martin's
there's
a Labour Party member. Off you go.
Who's in waiting?
Well, I think that's the issue. If you're going to get rid of him, you've got to think about what you're going to replace him with. And I think for the time being, there clearly are voices like John McDonnell, for example.
Starmer is a Klingon, isn't he? He's going to stay as long as he can.
And he said so.
Yes, he said he's going to. I mean, he's got a majority. He's got a majority of 200 and something. So
he's got a cabinet of Mandelsonians.
He's not, unless there's an absolute determination to get him out of the parliamentary Labour Party, he can probably hang on.
Well, also they purged the left, didn't they? Anyway,
yes, that's right.
They purged the left. So you say there's a cabinet of Mandelsonians. That's all that's left. It's the same with the Tory Party. They got rid of all the wets, and all they got is the swivel-eyed loons that are left. Do you know what I mean?
Would you vote for the swivel-eyed loons?
No.
What Starmer did when he became, and I voted for him as Labour leader, is he decided that he didn't need to do anything to the left at all, apart from disrespect it, kick it out. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is surprised to be kicked out of the Labour Party. He's been a member of the Labour Party longer than Keir Starmer's been alive.
And he brought in a failed Ed Miliband. They kicked out the guy that nearly won in 2017 and 2019. He kicked him out completely. So, anyways, a bit of a purge has been going on in the Labour Party. Mm. People tend to be a little bit disillusioned. And one of the most interesting types of Labour MP to hear from are the old school. And there's a lady called, I think she's from Canterbury, Kent or something, called Rosie Duffield. Let's have a listen to Rosie.
Where do you think this is heading with Sir Keir Starmer? Because he is saying in the newspapers that he plans to fight the next election. He thinks he's going to win it. You obviously are of the Labour family. How do you rate his chances of surviving?
I don't know anyone that thinks he could win the next election, if I'm honest.
What, including Labour MPs, because he says that there's a silent majority behind him?
I mean, possibly some of the new MPs disagree with me, but everybody I know that's been around for a while, I mean, we didn't ever really choose Keir to win an election. He was supposed to be a kind of bridging leader until, Boris Johnson called an election. There was going to be a coup. There are people whose names are in the room who've been planning to be the leader since then, so for sort of 5 or 6 years. So he was never the person we chose to fight the election because we knew it would be difficult on the doorstep with him. And although obviously Labour had a huge majority, he personally wasn't popular. So that wasn't really the plan. And he has shown the same level of kind of management rather than leadership throughout those 6 years.
You resigned from the party. Would it be your hope one day that you would rejoin the party?
Yeah, of course. I mean, my values are exactly the same. Everything I stood for on, you know, three elections hasn't changed, but I feel that the party has left its original intention, it's let people down, and it doesn't resemble the Labour Party, my Labour Party anymore.
In what way?
I think things like benefits, the welfare, you know, the welfare cuts, this two-child limit that we fought for so long. We had to fight tooth and nail with our own party alongside colleagues that were in the cabinet that had campaigned to reverse that since George Osborne brought it in. And it was just a real body blow to see that the party wasn't, had to be dragged kicking and screaming to do those very Labour things.
Quite a good interview there. That's with Roger Bolton on Times Radio. He does a programme on a Sunday morning, I suppose, to keep people out of church if they were inclined to go to church. It's actually quite good. I mean, Roger's pretty balanced, but she's an interesting character, Rosie, isn't she? She's using code there when she talks about new MPs. I use this word rather more openly, which is the Mandelsonian. These are the sort of the new neocon style Labour people. But there's still, obviously, there's still quite a strong reserve of people like Martin here.
There's sort a few that got in the party. That got in, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, or Mandelson didn't manage to get their local party to get them kicked out to bring one of his people in. And so there is still something, Martin, going on in the Labour Party, which is a little bit more like its traditional roots, as Rosie's talking about there.
Well, a party like the Labour Party isn't going to disappear overnight. These are, you know, times have changed. You know, you can't rely on people's loyalty in the way that you used to be able to do. What I think is very interesting is Andy Burnham next week is going to the Compass conference with Green and Liberal Democrat people, because the Compasses are in favour of proportional representation, and Burnham has said that he's in favour of proportional representation. Now, you could see, just envisage a situation where if Burnham was able to, because Clive Lewis, who's an MP in Norfolk, he's suggesting that he could stand down and then Burnham could get a seat, which would then give the opportunity for him to be the challenger for Starmer going forward.
Doesn't he have to get a... wouldn't Burnham have to get approval from Starmer to stand?
Well, he would, but I think it's widely regarded that putting Burnham out of Gorton and Denton was a mistake. Starmer didn't want him to be in there.
And I think there's been rumours that they would let him stand now.
Yes, yeah. I think the
last couple of weeks has come out.
I think more centrist people are thinking, well, we need to have an option here. Yeah. So if he really does keep tanking out, and Burnham is credibly different, and of course the interesting thing about Burnham, he said we need to change the electoral system. Now, if we can go into the next election either A, with an electoral system change, we've got a majority of 200 in Parliament, we could vote to change the electoral system before the next election. Yeah, well, of course, and I think this has always been the problem on the left. In a first-past-the-post setup, then votes get split, and Reform have got nothing like 50% support. But they could end up being the government on 30% support because of this electoral system.
Yes, because only 20% of the population voted.
Yeah, talking about PR, there's been some changes to the electoral system in Scotland, haven't there? Before we talk about the result, it's called the additional member system. Does anyone understand it?
No.
It's apparently some of the seats in the Scottish Parliament are first past the post and some are
That's
PR.
Right. That's right, yeah.
Well, you've got various systems of PR in different parts of the world. The Scottish system is an additional list system, so you get constituency votes, and then people from the list are added on according to the proportion of votes you've got. This is similar to some other European countries. Mm-hmm. But of course, in Wales, they've just made it more proportional, they've doubled the number of people.
Yes.
But I mean, this is another anomaly within the British setup, is that in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland, obviously, you've got a proportional system. In Northern Ireland, it was absolutely key to getting the Good Friday Agreement through, because otherwise, you know, that was what the fight was all about, is, well, are we getting fair representation here?
So, I mean, look, the point that Martin's made, one of the points that Martin's made is a really good one. He's made several, but there's one particular one, which is the Labour have a majority now. They actually have an option to make change. The problem is that usually the party in power doesn't want to bring in PR because it means they may not be in power. But the way that things have changed, the way that life has changed, the way that social media has changed our electoral system, the way, you know, we talked about the newspapers and their dwindling impact, but still helping to frame a debate. So Labour are now in a position to do whatever they want. So how about doing a couple of really good things like proportional representation, and, you know, I'll just throw this one in, a wealth tax of some kind. Just chuck
that. Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Or, I mean, we've
then
had,
they could have paid for the two channels.
Well, another story this week has been the second of the big quarterly profits from BP and Shell. I mean, this is absolutely horrific, and they're making a fortune out of, one wonders whether maybe Donald Trump is funded by BP and Shell, because he's brought in a massive bonus. They've got some sort of 5% dividend for the quarter for their shareholders, which is, what's that, over the year is a 20% dividend, 20% interest, folks. Why are your investments not in Shell and BP? And we'll get more war, and you can get more dividends.
I heard a guy being interviewed on the radio, and he was an economist for the economic editor of the on Sky, and he's been interviewed on another channel, and his whole shtick was about the UK should get involved in shale gas. Look at the American, it's a buried treasure. No. Buried treasure. He goes, I was in Texas, and all you could see for miles were those little heads bobbing up and down. And he thought that was a good thing. It's crazy.
Well, it is crazy. It's so destructive to the environment.
Exactly.
And all you need to do is open up the Straits of Hormuz instead of do this environmental earthquake destruction. So looking at the Scottish Parliament and the Senate in Cardiff, the count has only just started earlier today. So this is another thing we're seeing changing within our elections, general elections and local elections and regional elections, is that quite often now in the UK you're finding that the ballot boxes are incognito for 12, 14, 18 hours after the ballot closes. And so there will be some sort of private security guard keeping an eye on them. And we all know that private security guards can be bribed.
Like the guy, the Chinese guy that was done the other day, the Chinese security, well, he's a border former border patrol who's been done for spying on behalf of the Chinese government. So yes, it can happen.
You can.
They can be bought.
And
yes.
You know, we had a long conversation with one of the members of the Senate, Neil McEvoy. He's a very independent member. I would say I keep talking about when I see Neil. I said, "You're still there, Neil, the last independent politician left in Wales." But anyway, Neil was explaining how there's been tampering with seals on the election boxes overnight. So he's turned up and seen, the seals are broken on this box, and you're about to start counting it. Hang on, the police don't really seem to be interested in the South Wales Police, which he's got a running battle with, as many people have, in the South Wales Police, particularly after the Clydach murders, which were actually done, I think I can quite clearly say this, by a serving police officer who then managed to blame somebody else for it, fitted up somebody a bit like the Jill Dando, Barry George business. But so you know, you've got a situation where ballot boxes can be... This goes back a long way, Martin, doesn't it? I think the origin of this system is that everybody knew that once those ballots are closed, they come together immediately and the count starts straight away.
Yes, that's true. But, of course, in other countries, it's quite common for counting to take ages. I mean, in India, it often takes 2 or 3 weeks because it's such a big place.
We're not in
India. Well, no, I'm just saying that it's not the presumption that everything's got to be done in one night, because that's how we've always done it, is just a presumption.
I think they just don't want to pay overtime for the people to stay up at night and double rates, you know. And
that's
it's supposed to be a money-saving thing.
No, I'm going to hold the line
go ahead.
Electoral interference comes in all sorts of guises. This is one. Get in there, stuff the ballot boxes overnight while no one's looking. Another one, of course, is electronic voting.
Okay.
There are all sorts of ways to change an election.
The major factor is money. I mean, £9 million was given to Nigel Farage's party by a billionaire who lives in Thailand.
Yeah, he gave them...
The Labour Party is funded ultimately through my subs.
But anyway, let's have a look
That's all they've got.
The results, alleged results, after the ballot boxes were definitely not tampered with overnight, is in Scotland, is the SNP have got 55 so far, but that is -4, so they're falling. Reform, anyone like to guess how Reform are doing in Scotland?
I would say that they're definitely up because they were hated not 2 years ago.
Well, there was 0 2 years ago, exactly. So they're not up actually. They're still 0, so they're not doing very well at all in Scotland.
Okay.
We may revisit this at the end of the program, but they're all being counted up there. The Greens are doing quite well. They've got 2 seats. They had none before. The Labour Party are doing reasonably well in Scotland. They are up 2 from last time. In other words, these are 2 ones they've got against. It's not saying. So, for example, if the Labour Party lose a seat, or just lost a seat, that will go as a minus, but maybe they just haven't matured or evolved yet. So anyway, it's very difficult to say much other than the SNP are definitely going down. Other parties doing quite well. Now, there's more results in from Wales. The big gains are Plaid Cymru and Reform, Labour plummeting, Tories plummeting. So it almost looks as if the Greens have taken the place, Martin, or the Plaid Cymru have taken the place of the Greens in Wales.
Well, I mean, this is a very interesting development, isn't it? Because we've got a very varied political landscape now in the country.
But every single new seat that Reform have got, they never had any before. So they've gone +32 already.
Yeah,
today.
I mean, what's happened is that there's obviously a realignment going on the right. The Tories are basically dying the death, and Reform are picking up their votes, and they're also picking up what used to be some Labour votes. But nevertheless, like in most European countries, there's a fairly clear split in the electorate between the left and the right, same as in Spain, same as in Italy, same as everywhere, really. And of course, because we've got a first-past-the-post system and a devolved assemblies and all the rest of it, it gets very, very complicated. And at the end of all of this, of course, you could easily see a situation where the United Kingdom will be broken up. So you've got the former Yugoslavia, the FYU, but of the former UK.
Well, this was Tony Blair's work, wasn't it? Yeah. Back in 1999, I think.
Well, it's also the IRA's work. And from 1969 onwards.
Not in Scotland and Wales.
No, because that is part of our country. People think it's not.
Well,
it
the
is.
IRA weren't blowing
yes,
up anything.
They had
Martin,
to bring in proportional
can you just stop shouting? I'm just trying to explain. This is certainly true for Ireland, but it wasn't not in Wales. And also, it was partly to do with the joining the EU that these proportional representation elections were brought in Wales and Scotland.
That's right. And also, of course, proportional representation was how UKIP got a foothold in British politics.
Do you think, Don? Do you think we'll ever get there?
European
with this PR business in this country, or will we always be stuck in this old first past
I've
the
got
post?
I've got a feeling that PR is the future, to be honest.
Of course it is.
Some version of PR
it's got
is the
to
future.
Be.
And personally,
well,
like Martin,
does.
And it's like Martin, I would hope so. Unfortunately, the downside of it is that you will let in people like Reform. But they exist.
Listen,
I'd rather be able to see them.
Let's just be clear.
That's right.
Under first past the post, I don't know what the most recent up to date polls are, but we looked at a poll in January which gave them a 3 or 4 seat majority under first past the post. Now this they clearly know this. Then there's been the next thing that happened like 2 weeks afterwards. There was a big Israel lobby meeting with Nigel Farage and some of his top people. You know, all right, if we're going to be taking over, we want to make sure we've, and they started up this new thing called Reform Friends of Israel. It's depressing.
But they're the Nazis. Anyway,
how are Reform the Nazis? Come
no, you're talking about these races.
Reform, they're a racist party with a racist leader that platform racist people. That's Nazi-like
behaviour.
They
would say, if Reform were here, they would say, well, you're talking about the Tommy Robinson faction. We've made sure to keep them out of the party.
No, I remember when the woman that was convicted for being a racist was invited onto the Reform at the conference and clapped and hailed on stage. It had nothing to do with Tommy Robinson. She called for the death of people to be burnt in their homes or in the places that we're staying. Can I just go back just a step, though?
Yeah.
Because you said about the electoral system. I think you know, and I didn't really get to finish my point. The electoral system, including having things like PR, needs complete tearing it apart. So, you know, with the it shouldn't be about money. And that's where I started with this celebrity game show thing that politics has become. And it's about money. You know, in America, they're campaigning the day after the election. They're campaigning for their next election. We can't be like that. So I would rather that we had a system where the money was put down. This is how much an election costs. This is how much you've got for you and you got for you. And it's all sorted out. Here's the money for the councils so that the count can be the same night to remove that as opposed to, well, it's up to the council. Well, we're broke, so we can't pay overtime, so we're not doing it till tomorrow. You know, it's got to be bought and paid for. And I'd even throw in the Australian model, which is, it's compulsory.
Yeah.
It's compulsory.
Well, we had Farage this week talking about this massive donation that he got just a couple of days before he announced his intention to stand as an MP. And I'm looking at him thinking, the reason you didn't stand as an MP was because your legal people were telling you, look, don't stand as an MP yet because we could be getting a great big donation in. And is it this game? We've had enough of this game,
Bill. That's right. That's why I said it's a game show. And we need to take money out of politics. You know, it's that old joke about they should be like Formula One racing drivers, but the labels across their suits. This is ridiculous now. And so, again, electoral reform has to be widespread, and Labour have the majority and therefore the power to actually do it. But will they?
One of the things I really like about Polanski is this idea of prioritising. Okay, war is nothing to do with local councils, but general poverty, etc., is, and the cost of living is. And so this is a story that's come out this week, which I just touched on earlier, which has a massive, massive effect on everybody's disposable income.
Shell's first quarter profit beat estimates and hit its highest in 2 years at $6.9 billion on Thursday. It was boosted by gains linked to the Middle East war, leading the company to raise its dividend by 5%. At the same time, it slowed its quarterly share buyback program to $3 billion from $3.5 billion. That's to help divert cash to its balance sheet as a short-term liquidity squeeze after war-related energy supply disruption increased its debt. Shell's shares were down over 3% in early trading, broadly in line with other oil majors. That's as oil prices have retreated from peaks well above $100 a barrel. Shell's results echo big oil trading profits at its European peers BP and TotalEnergies, that also take speculative bets on moving prices, in contrast with their more cautious US rivals. Shell's oil and gas output fell 4% compared with the previous quarter, mainly due to outages in Qatar. Part of its Pearl gas-to-liquids plant was damaged in the Middle Eastern conflict. Shell said full repairs might take about a year.
Okay, so that's £5 million profit in a quarter that these oil companies, this one specifically, this week is Shell. Previously, we had something like, it was about £3 million profit for BP. Total is something similar, but that is mainly based in France. But the interesting thing about this, Martin, is this is a lot of this profit is to do with speculating on the oil futures market, etc. So they've been making a hell of a lot of money. So this is, well, we're talking about between those two businesses, something like $30 billion profit in a year, just to two oil companies. Now, this is getting insane. This sort of money is needed desperately to run our local authorities to, you know, this is just let's know, because it is a gambling thing that they're doing here with oil prices. And if they get a bit of inside knowledge from Donald Trump or one of his mates, Jared Kushner or somebody, then they can maybe double their profits in a week.
Well, that's right. I mean, the oil market is very unstable at the moment, and there's all sorts of speculation and insider trading going on in the US. Of course, this makes Rachel Reeves' attempt to balance the books when she came to power a couple of years ago look really silly. We're probably going to have a massive government crash program of government intervention once the crash happens, But we can't talk about that now because we're still in old think where we, you know, nothing radical can be done and we've got to tinker at the margin. But once we've been through a major crash, and that's what's going to happen, people will wake up and realise that, you know, you can't just fiddle around in a situation like this. And don't forget, BP used to belong to the British government.
So it did.
So all of that money would have gone straight into the British government's pocket back in the day before Margaret Thatcher.
But back into our pocket, our family's.
That's
silver.
That's the whole point. I mean, the British economy has been looted by the rentier classes.
Yeah.
And somebody like Farage, who is part of the rentier classes, who made £1.4 million last year whilst he was an MP. And you've got to ask yourself the question, were you doing MP job or you were doing your £1.4 million job?
Don, there's a bit of schizophrenia here because even though we're being told about nuclear, renewables, etc. is the future, officially by Ed Miliband, there's clearly people making an absolute fortune out of fossil fuels still, reluctant to move away from it.
Yes, and that's why there's this constant drill baby drill rubbish that resonates. It's why Reform have picked it up, you know, and why you see people at roundabouts waving things like, get rid of the windmills. We're in a very weird place where up is down and down is up. On David Attenborough's 100th birthday, I think we should just pause for a second and look at science. I saw a really interesting little clip. It's Neil deGrasse Tyson, who said, look, it doesn't matter. You could tear up every science book and then start writing them again. You're going to come up with the same answers. You know, you can tear up a religious book and you might write another. You write the Quran, you write the Talmud, you write a different book. But if you tear up a science book, when you start to rewrite it, eventually, after you test it, you'll write exactly the same book. Because facts are facts. And the damage to our planet that we are doing, man-made, person-made climate change, is real. And the only way to do it is to change it is for us to make the adjustments. And pouring more oil and carbon into the sky ain't going to cut it. It just ain't.
And of course, the Chinese have now got more than 50% of their electricity generation is non-fossil fuel.
That's right. They've got the nuclear.
They've got all.
When we come to discussing things like this, I always come out with the buses and railways. When we were youngsters, there were hardly any cars on the road. There were plenty of trains. Mm-hmm. They were cheap, very easy to, and they were basically provided at cost by BR, as they were at the time, back in the 1970s. And they were reliable, they were comfortable.
But that's part of the family jewels that have been sold off,
aren't
they?
If we wanted to go somewhere, trains. We would just walk down the street, there'd be a bus within 2 or 3 minutes, and it would take us to the station. We'd be up in London in, under an hour.
As you said, the family jewels aren't just the oil fields or the airlines. It's the gas, the oil, the water. It is also the trains and the tubes and the most successful underground system in the country is being run by the council, by the GLC, GLA, you know, the Greater London Assembly. Sadiq Khan is running that, and it's honestly, I you mentioned me being in London, but I still live in Bristol. I still live in Bristol, and I visit more. I've got grandkids, so I'm visiting more. But it's wonderful getting around. I have an Oyster card in London. I don't have one in Bristol. I'm sure I qualify, but no one tells you. There's no joined up helping you to navigate. No. And the point I think I'm trying to make is that, we need a revolution.
We need public provision,
solid
transport.
Solid reform.
Well, this is very, very simple, and it's actually, it works really well. In fact, it works so well that Ken Livingstone tried to make it free in London, didn't he?
Well, that was the ultimate
goal.
And
that would have been the absolute shot in the head for the car
industry. In Tallinn in Estonia and Seattle in the US, public transport is free.
And he was banned.
You just get on the bus, you don't even pay for it. Mm.
He was elected to do it, and then the courts and Bromley Council
said,
no, you can't do that. No, you can't. And then, of course, they abolished the entire Greater London Council. So this is the establishment is afraid of ideas like free public transport. Yeah. It really is. And that, of course, would make a massive difference to pollution. Because I've been reading this week this amazing book, Bomber Beaching, about the guy that shut the railways down, the Hatchet Man, in the 1963 Beaching Report, where he cut something like two-thirds of the train network across the whole country. You know what he didn't cut? anything in London, because you can't do it in London, because everyone relies on the trains. And everyone in London was pointing out, well, we've just had these horrendous 1950s London smogs, and you're saying it's a good idea to have loads and loads of cars on the road as well? So they had to have the Clean Air Act to clear up the London fogs, which were actually killing 3,000 mm-hmm. people in the winter in London. And then Beeching said, oh, I actually think it's okay. Look, now we've cut down on the use of coal, it's okay to start and get polluting again with all these cars running around. So it's a terrific book, that, by the way. Bomber Beeching, the something case of tunnel vision by Richard Cottrell, our old friend who used to come on and talk about Operation Gladio, also wrote a book about who Richard Beeching really was, and he calls him Bomber Beeching because he didn't know anything about the railways at all, or accounting. Perfect person for the job of doing all the railway accounts and cutting it all down.
Sounds like a Trump appointment.
Well, exactly. He was a metallurgist who'd been recruited to work on the British Atomic Bomb Project, and he knew how to keep his mouth shut. And that's why he was given the job of closing down the railways for the petrodollar. That was what it was really all about, because if we wanted to drill out any North Sea oil, the Americans had said, no, you can't have any North Sea oil money for the rigs until you open a domestic market for petrol, more petrol, and because otherwise you'll depress the world oil price if you start just drilling oil out. So the British government said, okay, well, we'll shut down the railways, is that okay? And the Americans said, yes, you can now start drilling out North Sea oil. So there you go, it's all in a bit of a nutshell. I think we should be moving on to look at the Defend Our Juries people in a minute. I don't know if you've got them on the line, Dave, have we? Okay. In which case, let's have a listen to Crispin Flintoff. He's been at the case of the Ukrainians this week, who are being charged, three Ukrainians, with the arson of a car and a property owned by Keir Starmer.
Right, it's day 8 of the Starmer arson trial. I'm just near St Paul's Cathedral. Just in case you're wondering, there's no wisteria. The main suspect, Roman Lavrinovich, has been cross-examined by the defence barrister, and he's told people a lot about his background. There's no mention of him being a rent boy. He's worked in hotels, he's worked in removals, he's worked in construction. His mother has been watching the trial on some occasions. His grandmother has been in this country for over 20 years. He came over to this country in 2022 because of the war in Ukraine. His father and mother are in Ukraine, although his mother has visited to look at the trial, and his father was very ill. And very movingly, I thought, the barrister was asking him why he was working and doing all this work and making money, doing all these odd jobs. And what he's done is buy two cars, second-hand cars. His dad is a second-hand car dealer, and he was sending those cars, those second-hand cars that he bought in England, over to Ukraine so that his dad could make some money from them. And obviously he did it because he wanted his dad to be proud of him. He's only 22 years old. This El Money guy clearly was grooming him to do bigger jobs, including some kind of attack on a car, whether it was painting a windscreen black or arson. But before that comes out, he talks about he just shows that he's not particularly intelligent. He's quite easy for someone to manipulate. The barrister asked him whereabouts in Ukraine he's from. He gave a town, and then the barrister said, where is it, north, south, east or west? And he couldn't actually answer north, south, east or west, as if he doesn't know north, south, east or west. So this guy is not particularly intelligent. He's easy to pick off. He's easy to manipulate. You just feel sorry for him if you're watching this case. His cross-examination will continue tomorrow in the morning. I just want to say something else as well. I suspected that his evidence would be a concern to people who don't want anything to be known about L money or anything like that. And lo and behold, there were two people in the gallery sitting next to near me who I'd never seen before, who looked very smart and just came for his testimony, and then they kind of walked off. It seems to me that whatever he says is significant to some people. So anyway, I'll be there tomorrow, and I'll give another report on his evidence. So that will be day 9.
Well, there's our man on the scene. Well, he's everyone's man on the scene, isn't he? Crispin Flintoff there. You can find him on all sorts of socials. I think I lifted that one off of his Facebook page yesterday afternoon. Just fantastic, Martin, isn't it, to hear someone doing such a detailed report on a story which is virtually being ignored in the mainstream press. It is important if the Prime Minister's car is attacked or his property, etc.
Yes, I mean, obviously, it's a very murky case, and it's very hard to work out what's going on. But I saw from the other day that this El Money person who's put them up to it...
Allegedly.
Yes, okay.
Even though we don't even know who it is.
Well, that's right. But I mean, but he actually got them to put up posters around the area where they lived, and the nature of those posters, according to Crispin Flintoff, was Islamophobic posters. Like, you know, there are too many Muslims around here.
Too many mosques, things like that.
Too many mosques. Now, in other words, whoever's put them up to it could possibly be linked, it may be, with Israeli intelligence rather than anything else. But we just don't know. And there's all sorts of things going on. Because, of course, as we pointed out with the Golders Green attack, which is, you know, the ambulances are all going to be replaced at taxpayer expense. And the evidence suggests to me that there's an orchestrated campaign by Israeli intelligence services in Australia, for example. There's lots of attacks on Jewish community centres, and they blame the Iranian ambassador and expelled him. Now, this is a deliberate creation of narrative by the Israel lobby that the attacks on Jewish communities in Europe and Australia are being carried out by nasty people paid for by the Iranians.
Well, they might be, mightn't they?
No, none of it adds up. The Iranians have got no track record of doing... The Bondi Beach attack was carried out by two guys associated with ISIS from the Philippines. Now, of course, the Chinese, the Russians and the Iranian general staff are all very well aware that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are front organisations for the Western Intelligence Service and the Saudis.
Well, that's certainly an opinion. Anyway,
it's not just an opinion. They're making their decisions on that basis. We've got Al-Qaeda in charge in Syria. We paid for that. We trained him. We've put him in power. And, of course, everybody in the Middle East knows that Al-Qaeda is a puppet of the West.
Al-Qaeda people are quite persuasive. Look, we're joined on the line by Tim Crossland. Hi, Tim.
Hey, good evening.
Tim, we're really pleased that you've managed to carve out some time for us this evening. Thanks very much. You know, Tim, would you like to, because I know you're one of the founders of Defend Our Juries, we've seen some really disturbing developments over the last few years, but even just in the last few weeks. What is the point of defending our juries? Why do we need to do it?
Well, because juries are, you could see them as an oasis of authentic democracy in this country. They bring the common sense of ordinary people into the criminal justice system. And it's a counter to some of the influence of the arms industry and the fossil fuel industry that is so powerful in distorting our justice system at the moment.
We were talking earlier on a little bit about David Lammy, Justice Secretary, and this attempt to actually remove juries from trials. Is that being progressed? Is that going to happen?
Well, they're pushing forward with it. And yes, I mean, this is a shockingly anti-democratic thing, because if you take a poll of people in this country, people like juries. And it's not that surprising, really, because juries are people. And it's where we've actually got some real influence. And it allows people to send a message to power when things are not going as they should do.
Well, look,
if climate activists are prosecuted and the jury refused to convict, that sends a message to the government, we need more climate action. If people are prosecuted for opposing a genocide and the jury refuses to convict, that sends a message to the government, the people of this country do not support complicity in genocide. So it's a really vital role that juries have. And after a succession of jury acquittals in high-profile political cases, including, of course, in Bristol, the Colston Four, 12 randomly selected members of the Bristol public making a decision on whether that was a crime to topple the statue of the slave trader Edward Colston into Bristol Harbour, and they decided it wasn't. That's democracy in action, having heard the evidence. The government didn't like it. The government appealed that decision. And this move from Lammy to remove jury trial altogether is part of that same project.
Well, we think, well, we like to think anyway here in Bristol that non-violent direct action is almost in our DNA here. And I know that there was an assault on an Elbit Israeli drone arms factory at Filton. What surprised me more than anything else was that we've had actually, it seems like, double jeopardy going on here. So can you just clear up what's been going on with this trial? It's like, and I may be wrong about this, but it looks as if they were originally charged with aggravated burglary, suspects here, which does seem bizarre because they weren't trying to burgle drones, they were trying to smash them up quite clearly. And then on a lesser charge of criminal damage, now it looks as if they've been convicted, but that seems to break all the rules. So when the police are charging and when the Crown Prosecution Service are charging, they have a whole, often quite a lot of different potential charges. They have to choose the one they think has got the best chance, and they can't, if they get it wrong, go back and try it again.
Well, you'd like to think that was the principle, yes. But just to go back to the incident itself, I guess assault's a bit of a loaded word, because the context here is drones making their way from Bristol and other Elbit factories around Britain to the Israeli Defence Force to be used to perpetrate horrific crimes against civilians, against children, against women, against people of Palestine. And the government acting unlawfully by failing to act in accordance with the rulings of the International Court of Justice, the rulings of the International Criminal Court, and ordinary people of conscience not accepting being bystanders and deciding if the government is going to make itself complicit in those crimes, we need to take action. So to my way of looking at it, that is a protective act. It's an act of conscience. And then, yes, I mean, charged with the most extraordinary things for taking action to prevent a genocide. The, in the phrase, you know, turning swords into plowshares. It's meant to be, you know, one of our basic moral principles. That's what they're doing. And between December and February, a long, long trial, the jury refused to convict them of anything, threw out all the most serious charges, and somehow back again, you know, within a couple of months on trial again, despite all the delays in the justice system. And four of them have now been convicted of criminal damage. And two found not guilty, which is, you know, bizarre in itself, because it's all on the same facts. And some of them have already spent a long, long time in prison, in extreme conditions. But it's a little bit difficult to talk about exactly what went on inside that courtroom, because there are very severe reporting restrictions that prevent the public from hearing exactly
okay,
what happened.
Okay, well, let's just say, if you don't mind me just intervening just quickly, I think what it is, I think, is to do with sentencing. So if the authorities, and I'm talking about that rather than just the judge, because the judge is not necessarily working totally on his own here and without influences, what they can do, if there is a conviction on a lesser charge, then they can start maybe possibly tweaking behind the scene, tweaking the sentencing and changing the way that individuals, and upping the amount of advice that they're getting to change the sentencing. So I think we probably better leave it at that. But how is it possible to have this double jeopardy? Surely when they walk out of the courtroom, they're free. There's no more, sorry, we're going to arrest you again and try again.
Well, it's the answer to that is on the criminal damage charges, they weren't acquitted. The jury didn't agree. It's what's called a hung jury. So in that situation, it is not so unusual for there to be a retrial. The speed of the retrial is another thing. So they were acquitted on the aggravated burglary charges you mentioned and other serious charges, but on the criminal damage, it was a hung jury. So that's why it came to court again. But the thing that we can talk about, because this is out there now, is on the last day or the last day of the sort of trial proceedings before the jury deliberations, before the defendants gave their speeches, five of the six defence barristers left the proceedings. It wasn't because they'd fallen out with the defendants. They stayed to watch. It was clear the relationship was still good. But one of the defendants said in open court, the orders made by the court have made it impossible for our barristers to act on our behalf. Now, there's something else we now know. One of the barristers, Rajiv Menon KC, who gave a brilliant speech in the first trial. It was reported, a lot of people said this is the best speech ever heard. Absolutely brilliant. And he talked about, you know, the obligation on people to step up around the genocide. And he made some points that are completely correct in law, that the judge cannot direct the jury to convict. If he could, what would be the point of having a jury? Because of that, the judge, Mr. Justice Johnson, referred Rajiv Menon for contempt of court, which is a serious criminal charge. The barrister is now being prosecuted for that, facing what are essentially criminal proceedings, for having pointed out what is true, that the judge cannot direct the jury to convict, in the middle of the trial. And you might think that if that's the sort of thing the judge does, it's not altogether surprising if other barristers feel they're not able to represent their clients. And the day after the convictions came through, that judge, Mr. Justice Johnson, receives a promotion.
Don, who's joining us in the studio, is chuckling away there. This is just horrific, though, isn't it, Tim? How is this sort of thing allowed to happen? I mean, I can remember from the 1990s, it was quite a well-known case at the time, and we watched the young ladies all getting being given a acquitted on the news in the evening. One evening in the 1990s, they had gone into a weapons factory. It was a British aerospace weapons factory. The Hawk aircraft were being sent to the dictatorship in Indonesia, and they were being used to massacre innocent people, attack villages in Indonesia. So they decided, as part of the Trident Plowshares organization, to go in and disable this aircraft. And the jury back in the 1990s looked at this case, said, well, actually, this is stopping a much greater crime. And the jury agreed, the barrister acting for them. In fact, they'd gone to the trouble of even doing a film about why they were about to do what they did before they did it, which was also shown to the jury. So what's changed since then? Surely, if you commit a crime, which is stopping a far greater crime, surely a jury needs to know this.
Yeah, we've got a long and honourable history of this. You know, these are some of the figures. It's not just in Bristol. These are people celebrated in Parliament Square, you know, whether it's the suffragettes or Nelson Mandela. This is part of democracy, because if people can't speak out and act for the greater good, you know, we're not really a democracy at all. But you ask what's changed. Well, what's changed is our democracy has got hollowed out to the point that we have effectively lobbyists for the oil and arms industry writing our laws. We actually had Rishi Sunak thank Policy Exchange for drafting the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act, which introduced a 10-year sentence for public nuisance causing any disruption. And we know that Policy Exchange is funded by the fossil fuel industry. We know, because of Freedom of Information requests, that Elbit Systems had meetings with the Home Office where they raised with them concerns about juries acquitting Palestine Action. And we know, because, I mean, most of that, it's been redacted, but the little bit that's unredacted said purpose of the meeting to reassure Minister Elbit Systems that we take their concerns seriously. So this is what has changed. What the democracy that we had has been hollowed out.
I actually, Donald, this is Don here. Yeah, right? I do have. I'm not sure if it's a question. Maybe it's just a comment. Because this is the United Kingdom, and in the United Kingdom, you damage property, you damage capital, then you're probably going to lose. But then you add into it Israeli government connection, and with what's going on, then I was surprised that they got out. They were acquitted, or it was a hung jury the first time, because I think the whole pressure is to support that war. The speed in which you mentioned the speed in which the retrial took place. Why is it so slow for the government to act on the genocide itself that we've all seen in front of our own very eyes and make a decision and say, yes, it is a genocide, or how do we put pressure on them to speed up? We don't need an international court. We need a government to take a position, and then maybe a lot of this would.
Yeah, be sorted.
Yes. Well, of course, that's true. I mean, people are having to break into drone factories because of... It's not just government inaction, is it? It's government complicity.
Yes.
And we know that the trigger for the prescription of Palestine action was breaking into Bryce Norton, RAF Bryce Norton, and that was so embarrassing for the government because what it did was draw attention to the RAF flights over Gaza in support of the Israeli government. So it's not just about not taking action against it, it's the active support, the active complicity. And we will all remember, I'm sure, Keir Starmer in October 23 being asked the question, is it okay to cut off water and electricity from a whole civilian population? We all know that is a war crime. And here was the human rights lawyer who had acted as defense in one of the cases we've talked about. And he said, well, Israel has a right to defend itself. Well, nobody has a right to commit genocide and war crimes. So this is the, of course, this is the issue, the active complicity of the government. And this is why people who attempt to hold it to account are facing such severe consequences. And we're all seeing now that, even the peaceful marching, people who never intended to be the wrong side of the law at all, are being told that simply marching against the genocide is enough to make you a criminal.
Well, look, it seems to me, Tim, there's clearly been interference in our court system. When that sort of thing happens, we really only have the last court of appeal, which is the Fourth Estate, the London Press, to fall back on. How do you think they've performed? Have the activities of Defend Our Juries been fairly reported?
I don't believe the activities of Palestine Action have been fairly reported. I think some of the coverage around that has been shocking, and a press that isn't pointing out the basic truth that juries can see, that these are people trying to protect, trying to prevent a genocide. Some of that's fear because of the prescription. In terms of the Defend Our Juries, I think the scenes that people have seen of, elderly vicars and priests and disabled people being hauled into the back of police vans in Parliament Square just for holding cardboard signs, I think that speaks for itself. And it's been hard to, undermine that or say with any credibility that that is a threat to the state. And on the whole, I think that has been a total disaster for the government.
So are there chapters of Defend Our Juries in different parts of the country? I just wonder if listeners are interested how they can find out a bit more about you.
Go online, find our website. There will be actions coming up. There'll be something on the 18th of May around defending our juries outside local Crown Court. So Bristol Crown Court, defend our juries, because you know, juries is people power. This is how we hold the corrupt, the powerful to account. So that would be one thing I would recommend. But please have a look at the website. There'll be more information there about how to work together collectively to stand up for democracies, to stand up against genocide and corruption.
Okay. And can you just give a website, web address, if people are interested in finding that? Where will we find you?
Just give me 2 seconds to get it right. DefendOurJuries.net.
Okay, Tim Crossland, one of the founders of Defend Our Juries, I think possibly one of the most important little outfits in the UK today, keeping the wolves from the door, keeping the barbarians from the gate. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much. A pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Martin, what do you make of this organisation? Because it does seem as if the juries are under attack. And they're not only juries, as we've just heard, the barrister too.
Yes, very sinister. And you can envisage that we may get a Farage government which will bring in totally repressive legislation against their political enemies. We're going to go through a major economic crisis now, probably every bit as bad or worse than the 1930s. So we really are on a slippery slope here. And the manipulation by the state of the court system is blatant and obvious. And, of course, you know, civil wars happen. They do. They happened in Yugoslavia. They happened in Ireland. This is what we're, you know, this is the danger we're facing as a society.
It's almost as if the juries are going to be actually getting much, much more important if there's political trials going on.
Well, they're abolishing Northern Ireland. I mean, you could even, of course, courts in Northern Ireland have no jury.
It's quite important. I think many of these Palestine Action people alleged attacking the building non-violently, peacefully, apparently, in Filton, have actually been interned. I mean, they've been in prison for, you know, best part of 2 years.
That's right, because they didn't. There was no reason to put them in prison. Yeah, they could have just been let. You know, they've got to go to trial, but there's no reason to keep them. They've made their prison conditions as difficult as possible, as trying to deter them. And of course, there was hunger strikes took place, which were very serious hunger strikes. Some of the people involved were on hunger strike longer than IRA hunger strikers in 1980. So it's a very, very, you know, it's a very febrile situation. And of course, the general situation in the world at large, and the global economy is absolutely terrifying. You know, there's a real possibility that, for example, that loads of people are going to die of starvation before the end of the year because of what's happening. And this, of course, is going to create huge upheaval.
But that doesn't matter too much if it's not here in the UK, does it?
Well, people in the UK will just find that their standard of living will collapse. Even so that, what they're used to, they won't get it anymore.
It seems to me, this is Zach, the one thing I like about Zach, well, I like quite a lot of things about him actually, but he's actually the only one who's really got some ideas to deal with the cost of living. Don, anyway, we're going to be having our break in a minute. Thanks very much for joining us. I just wonder if we're looking at, in the election, in terms of the election, a collapse of Labour in England and in Wales, not in Scotland. But certainly, well, they're not all that powerful in Scotland anyway. But this does look like a bit of a sea change where we've got the promise of a new government coming in. When you were last on the programme, great new Labour government. Actually, now the voters are saying, we've had enough of you already.
Wide but shallow. But they had pretty much had enough of them about 2 days after the election. I have the same attitude that I have to Brexit. You bought it, so now you own it. And England and Wales, this is on you. You know, this is where we are. And perhaps we have to go through this in order to maybe get to a better place. However, if you look across the pond, the direction of travel is not good. People are arrested in America for having blank cards, right? Blank placards, if you remember. And, you know, and we're going in that direction. So it's not good, but I'm going to be a long-termist and think that maybe in 30, 40 years, we'll get in a better place, but we may have another 10, 15 years of really horrible
stuff.
That's
a long time to wait. Do you think there are any lights at the end of the tunnel, like literally within months or years, that will deal with this establishment? establishment, which seems to be hell-bent on supporting genocide and actually impoverishing and crushing the vast majority of people in this country.
I think that somebody needs to take Keir Starmer into a dark room, a group of people, and have a chat with him about ideology and belief and progressive politics, and maybe do a deal with the Greens and water down some of Polanski's stuff, but bring some progressive as opposed to regressive policies into the Labour, wealth tax, electoral reform, full and complete. There's got to be something for the people that is very visible, vocal, and now, not in 2 years' time-ish. And the first one would be a wealth tax, I think.
Okay, Donald Mack, thanks very much. You're for welcome. Joining us. Thanks. We're going to go for our break now.
Well, I'm on my way to heaven. We shall not be moved. On our way to heaven, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the waterside, we shall not be moved. We shall not, we shall not be moved. We shall not, we
Le money, il sur le tableau. Il money, le money sur le tableau. Sir, the palace of excess leads to the palace of excess.
That and well, there's lots of being lost in music there. So two completely different versions, one from Sister Sledge from the 1970s, and then we had The Fall from 1993 from an album, The Infotainment Scan, I believe that's from, and that was Marquis Smith right at the very end. Sandwiched right in the middle, we had Sheila and B Devotion with Spacer, that's 1979. And right at the very start, it was, I believe, The Seekers, wasn't it? Yes, that's right. We Shall Not Be Moved. And I think, in a way, you know, defend our juries. There you go. No, they're not going to be moved. Anyway, welcome back to not the BCFM. No, it's actually, no, sorry. The Bristol Politics Show. It has been for months, Tony. Wake up. With Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And me, Tony Gosling, and I think maybe part of the programme we should just launch in really and look at the incredible situation again in it with Donald Trump. The idea, Martin, seems to me to be, is to keep everybody guessing, the entire world, in fact.
Well, that's right, and I don't. It's hard to work out whether he's got some overall plan it doesn't seem as if he have. It has.
Is he really in charge here? I mean,
obviously not. But right. Because the point is that he's a kind of a disruptive character at the heart of it all. His previous administration, he was basically, you know, the more straightforward people were, you know, steering him in various directions.
Don, who was chatting earlier, was talking about tribes, that actually the political parties are becoming, rather than a broad church, a rather cliquey tribe. And that's one of the big evolutions that we've seen. So maybe the same is true for the MAGA movement and the deep state in the States.
Well, that's right, but the politically important stuff is that the MAGA movement is splintering. So people like Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens...
Well, hasn't it just fulfilled its purpose? It's now being discarded like a stage rocket on a Saturn V. Well,
that's right, but I mean, there are still some people in the US who think Donald Trump is, has got a plan and he's going to solve their problems. Others are beginning to realise that he's potentially dangerous. And of course, a lot of his supporters really are not happy with the pro-Israeli policies he's pursuing.
Well, it's look,
because that's the, because he's
the reason
he's been
so unhappy
and blackmailed.
The reason he's so unhappy is because he promised not to do any of this.
Well, that's right. What he said was, if you vote for me, I will keep us out of wars. And of course, he hasn't done any such thing.
He's done the total opposite. Yeah,
exactly,
so,
opposite.
You know, it could be a betrayal, you could call it. Anyway, it seems to me he's kind of a spokesperson for the deep state faction that put him there in the first place. But I remember when we were discussing this a couple of years ago, and there were all these court cases against Donald Trump saying, well, isn't it weird? Because even though the Trump's support seems to be increasing, so they're not stopping these court prosecutions of Trump. You would have thought they would realise, and I think it's pretty clear now, this US establishment just wanted everybody to believe that he was some sort of anti-establishment maverick, which he clearly wasn't and isn't. But anyway, let's have a listen now to some of the latest pronouncements. This is from ABC television yesterday evening, a clip, very short clip.
The U.S. confirmed three of its military vessels came under Iranian fire in the Strait of Hormuz Thursday. According to CENTCOM, no U.S. assets were struck and forces were able to intercept the attack. The U.S. called the attack unprovoked, saying Iranian forces launched multiple missiles, drones, and small boats at military vessels. CENTCOM says it does not seek escalation, but remains positioned and ready to protect American forces. CBS News has also learned the U.S. carried out strikes on two Iranian ports in retaliation. President Trump told ABC News the strikes Thursday were a, quote, love tap.
Well, a love tap. The abuse of language gets worse and worse, doesn't it?
So Trump has hit, or the Americans have hit these ports. Then there's the Iranians have hit back at the ships. The Americans say no, they haven't. But anyway, it was just a love tap. I mean, this is, he's just playing games. It seems to me there isn't any kind of idea of the gravity of what's going on in this war.
No, and I think we all need to take account of the fact that this could spiral out of control very, very easily, very easily. The Iranians are not going to give way. There's no reason for them to give way. These ships that came close to the Iranians, they fired at them. They probably could have sunk them, because I understand they were down to just using machine guns to shoot down the drones, because they'd used up all of their ship interceptor missiles. And of course, they can't get anywhere near the Iranian coast, because they'll all be sunk, which is why they're all quite a long way away. But of course,
how far away?
Well, they're hundreds of miles away.
Right,
because they've got to, you know, because
but they can still enforce a blockade.
Well, they can enforce a blockade further out, but of course, a lot of the ships that the Iranians are pushing through, their ships, they're sticking close to the Iranian coast. Then they're going around the Pakistani coast.
Is there such a thing as a submarine container ship that can go underneath and sneak
past
the Americans?
Yeah, drug cartels have them. Yeah, they're quite common. But, of course, you can't get that much into them.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the point is,
a lot of people want them right now.
Yeah, the point is that although the Iranians are setting up their Persian Gulf Authority, where you've got to, you know, you have to ask for permission to go through and you've got to pay them. But the double blockade by Trump and the US Navy and the Iranians means that the danger for the global economy gets worse by the hour. Yeah, if they could, the stock markets are absolutely in denial, because every time Trump says he's doing some kind of a deal, or pretending he's doing some kind of a deal, that pushes up the stock market and pushes the oil price down. And of course, they're betting on all of that. Well, you know, all the people around Trump are betting on all of that.
Petulant and capricious. This isn't going to be good for the markets, is it?
No, it isn't. But the markets themselves are in a massive bubble, because of AI and all the rest of it. And at the moment, the market is functioning as if there is going to be a massive boom because of the AI and all the rest of it.
Really?
Now, of course, Keynes pointed this out years ago. Markets can stay irrational far longer than you can stay solvent. It's an irrational level. The market's at an irrational level. But if you're all, it's like a herd instinct. If everybody's doing the same thing, you can't lose money if the market's going up.
Well, there seems to me there's a tribe, at a certain point, it'll snap. Tribe of a small clique of people who think AI is the future. Anyway, look, let's have a listen to Michael Hudson as our sort of top star performer this week, talking about Iran. Here he is on, isn't it called Dialogue Works, I think, or Glenn Deason. Is it Glenn Deason?
Yeah.
There is no deal that's going anywhere. There is no change in the situation that's existed since last week. But fantasies are going full speed ahead. Yeah. Who does believe Mr. Trump? Well, the stock and the bond markets, as Richard just pointed out. And they have more money to back up their fantasy than Richard and I have to cope with their gullibility and with reality. So they don't seem to realize that with all of this frenetic GAMP speculation based on what Trump says, is that what he says has nothing to do with the actual reality. He says we're negotiating and a deal is near with Iran. I believe Iran when it says there's been no negotiation, because there cannot be any inherently under all of the terms that the United States has said. For one thing, suppose that there is a negotiation and the United States makes the promises that it's been holding out. We're going to release all the money that we've grabbed over the last 50 years from you, since 1979, when we froze your accounts. We're going to relax the sanctions that we've posed upon you. You know, you'll be able to grow again. Isn't all you have to do is make an agreement to what we're asking is quite simple. You have to promise not to build an atom bomb. Once he talks about atom bomb, he means, first of all, it takes 3 years to negotiate any kind of agreement, such as Obama did. Secondly, the agreement was under Obama that the Atomic Energy Group can come in and investigate all of the scientists, say where they live, tell the Israeli assassination teams who to kill, what universities to blow up, what professors to kill, so that Iran can have no training in physics or atomic energy or anything else. Secondly, anything that the United States agrees to, it can say, well, we can't control what Israel does, and so Israel will do all of the dirty work, or whatever mercenaries the United States chooses to do. Finally, suppose there were an agreement that somehow Iran could make up with the United States. All of this to become official and not just a handshake agreement, like when America promised not to expand NATO eastward in 1991, Congress would have to approve. And there's probably zero chance for this, because America has extended the concept of a free market to politics. And politicians are sort of, in order to get elected, you put yourself up for auction. Who is going to give us the largest campaign contributions to represent their economic and political interests? Well, the largest contributors are, well, the oil industry, the IT industry, the monopolies, the Zionists, and just to sort of increase the pot. Congress, for instance, will give billions of dollars to Israel with the agreement that a lot of this money will be recycled back into Israeli lobbying in the United States, contribute to the campaign, the political campaigns of the politicians that make this agreement with Israel. So given the, the lack of enforceability, what is the point even of having a discussion about alleged agreements that everybody knows cannot be enforced? And you mentioned, just imagine what is going to happen. Think of the next 2 weeks. Trump is planning to go to China. And he's not going to do anything at all because he wants anything attack more than simply attack blocking Iranian ships bringing oil to China would lead President Xi to say, well, look, there's going to be nothing to discuss. We're canceling the trip. So what is he? What are the American aircraft carriers and the destroyers and all the troops that have been pushed into the Near East going to do for the next 2 weeks? The press is full of reports saying that they're low on food. They're eating scraps for food, that the naval members seem to be in a mutinous condition. And after the 2 weeks are up, then comes all of the hot weather for the summer that is going to really affect the low-lying countries throughout the Persian Gulf area, much more than Iran itself. Being mountainous, it has at least better natural air conditioning than you're going to have from the long, hot summer there. So nothing is really going to happen. So all that we're dealing with is in a kind of fantasy world where the United States is continuing to block Iran. And I'm glad you brought up President Trump's correction of Besant's statement to say, well, yeah, of course we're pirates. Well, piracy, such as the United States is doing by seizing the Iranian tankers, is legally an act of war. So, of course, the war is still on. Trump is trying to get around the small print of the War Powers Act that limits the length of time that a president can go to war. But if you're still committing acts of war by piracy, you're still at war. And that's going to continue. And to at some point, Iran, if what Trump said is true and these sanctions are really hurting Iran, then Iran will respond to the act of war with a response against countries, probably beginning with the United Arab Republics. It's made a deal with Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. We're not going to let American aircrafts take off, use our airspace to attack you. That's what Iran asked them to do. The UAE, the Emirates, have said, well, you can use us. And somehow I don't think the Emirates are long for this world. But at any rate, what we're seeing is a stalemate for the time being. And it looks like there is not going to be war in the next few days or weekends. But there won't be any move toward a resolution either. Slowly, the U.S. economy and the world economy is going to be starved for oil, and the situation will get worse and worse and worse. And all of that is in Iran's favor, not the United States.
It's going to be actually quite good for the oil companies, as we've already seen. This uncertainty enables them to jack the price of fuel up. They're making a fortune. The government doesn't really seem to mind either, because they're still getting in their slice of the pound of flesh from the taxes that they put on all of our fuel. But it frustrates me, listening to people like Michael Hudson, that none of this analysis is in our mainstream news at all. Martin, I mean, things, basic things like, well, the Saudis and the Kuwaitis are starting to do deals with Iran. So what's happening is that these various Gulf states, just one by one, and of course this is likely to carry on. With all of them maybe eventually having to saying, well, actually, we would rather do a deal with the Iranians because they're our close neighbours than these remote Americans who seem so capricious and bizarre. So is he right that the Emiratis, the United Arab Emirates, may not be long for this world?
I think all of these societies, which were basically created by the British, you know, this, we created all of these states. They're very fragile. Very fragile.
Well, a lot of the commentators are saying that actually, in the last couple of weeks, because of these disastrous decisions by Donald Trump and everything backfiring in his face, that really a massive power shift has quietly taken place, with the Kuwaitis and the Saudis caving in, really, to Iranian pressure, and actually that the Americans have put on them, that this could be actually a massive change, with the Saudis and the Kuwaitis starting to be cooperative with the Iranians and saying, well, would actually rather these American military aircraft left here because you're not going to be able to use them anyway.
Well, what happened was Project Freedom that Trump pushed, the Saudis put the kibosh on that, said you can't use our air bases for it.
Well, Donald Trump was saying to them, you're going to kiss it, Mohammed bin Salman is kissing my backside, he said,
yes,
which isn't the best sort of
diplomacy. Well, no, he's no diplomat, is he?
No.
He just likes telling people what to do.
The Saudis anyway, are now
the interesting thing is that there was an attack on the oil terminal outside the Gulf in the United Arab Emirates. I can't remember the name of the terminal. Because the United Arab Emirates have been the most belligerent, they're the most pro-Israeli of all of the Gulf states. And of course, they've fallen out with the Saudis. And what it looks like, and what's being bruited around, is that it wasn't the Iranians that attacked the oil terminal. It was, in fact, the Saudis that attacked the oil terminal, because they and the United Arab Emirates are daggers drawn anyway over what's going on in southern Yemen. So, in other words, the kaleidoscope is now shifting.
What is going on in southern Yemen?
Well, in southern Yemen, you've got the separatists who want to have a different, you know, they want to break away from north Yemen, which is controlled by Nasrullah. But the Saudis are not happy with that. So the United Arab Emirates have been pushing their proxies in Yemen, in the south of Yemen, to split the Yemen up. But they've actually been run out, you know, they've actually been defeated by the Saudis. So the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates are actually at daggers drawn. And of course,
this makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
From a sort of east-west point of view, or Iran-Israel point of view, everyone is sort of lining up. But look, there are other Gulf states.
Yeah.
There's also, of course, there's Bahrain, which we haven't mentioned.
That's a very, very fragile state, because the majority of the people in Bahrain are Shia and sympathetic to Iran. But the ruling family, the Al Khalifa family, were put in power by the British, in the 19th century. It only got independence from Britain in 1971. And of course, there's no democracy in Bahrain. Yeah, it's a dictatorship.
And what about Oman? Because many years ago used to be part of Yemen, didn't it?
No, Oman is one of the oldest of these states, and in fact was.
It was North Yemen and South Yemen.
No, North Yemen and South Yemen are Yemen. Oman is not Yemen.
Nothing to do with it.
They're similar things. They're both geographical places, you know, but they're not the same place.
And the other thing is they're outside the Straits of Hormuz, which is where UAE is.
Well, the UAE is both. It's got stuff on the inside and it's got stuff on the outside.
Well, UAE is on the one side where, I'm just trying to explain this, UAE is on one side, whereas Iran is on the other side of the Straits of Hormuz.
That's right, but also the UAE has access to the sea beyond the Straits of Hormuz.
Both sides.
Yeah.
Hence, this is a place that the Americans want to control. If they can have influence there.
If you've seen Richard Medhurst's stuff, he's based in Vienna, He's talking about what this actually looks like is the US deep state is trying to control all the choke points for oil across the world in order to try and strangle the Chinese economy. But of course, it's not
working. And the European economy.
Well, I mean, they're going to kill everybody else while they're doing
it. Apparently, the Americans are now bragging about how everyone is happy to come cap in hand for them. Oh, we've got plenty of oil. You can send your tankers here.
This is,
well, if you can get them out from the Strait of Hormuz. Yeah, and this is deals. Companies are doing deals with the Americans saying, well, look, if you start actually getting your oil from us, you can come out of the Strait of Hormuz now.
Yeah, well, the Americans are not in position to say anything that happens in the Strait of Hormuz. It's the Iranians who are completely in control of it. But the what's...
Hang on, because the Americans, Martin, maybe you can clear this up. The Americans are saying we are going to board tankers, and we were just hearing about piracy, if they come through the Straits of Hormuz without our permission.
Well, what they can do is as ships leave the Straits of Hormuz, which have been cleared by the Iranians, they can always stop them further on. And they have been doing that. But the point is, it's actually quite difficult to do that because the ships, the Iranian ships that are going to China actually go in the territorial waters of Iran, then into the territorial waters of Pakistan, then into the territorial waters of India, and at no point do they actually go into the open sea. But of course, they're trying to stop the Straits. You can see what the strategy is. If we can control all of this oil, you know, from Venezuela.
So where else other than... So Venezuela, you mentioning there. Also the Persian Gulf. Where else in the world?
Well, obviously, they can't control the Russians. The Russians are coining...
What about Malacca? Straits of Malacca?
Well, the Straits of Malacca are potentially blockable. Yeah, because they're only...
This is Indonesia, I think.
That's it. It's between Malaysia and Indonesia.
And it blocks... And this is a route used by the Chinese a lot.
It's a route used by everybody.
It's another
blockade. Potential
blockade. Various sea routes are being squeezed all around the world, but we're not really hearing much about that, are we? Yeah,
well, this is the global war. It's a World War III, and that's what it's about. It's happening on every continent.
But do you think the Americans are running out of food, you see, is talking about there, saying that they're getting a bit annoyed because the sailors on the ships, the Marines, etc., are eating scraps? Is that just...
Yeah, well, I mean, if you keep
rubbish?
People out there for months at a time...
They must be able to supply them with a few army rations.
Well, they can, but at the same time, they're running out of all sorts of things, because, you know, you can't just keep everybody at condition red
it's
for
not,
months at a time.
To be fair, it's not the easiest thing to do, to be flying supplies backwards and forwards to...
No, it's not, and
ships.
That's what... They're operating thousands of miles from their home bases. They used to have a base in Bahrain, which is now rubble. Yeah,
well,
all of the bases that have come out this week, all of the US bases have been absolutely systematically demolished. There are no use to them at all. So the whole Fifth Fleet was based in Bahrain. Now they can't go there because there's nothing there. Yeah. And a lot of these, I mean, in the United Arab Emirates itself, there are 1 million Emirati citizens who don't do any work and 10 million workers who come in from all over the world to do all the work. And the oil fields in Saudi Arabia on the east side of the country, all the oil workers are Shia, yeah? Because the Sunni ruling class in Saudi Arabia doesn't do any work. They don't do work. But the Shia, who are, you know, a definite underclass, they are the oil workers. So they could at some point go on strike, burn the oil industry down, create a little Shia state on the banks of the Gulf. You know, and the Saudi state is actually, you know, just an outside creation, really. I mean, the original Muslim lands were a caliphate, so they were all one big empire. Having lots of little states like this was definitely... The British just basically took local families and said, we're going to put you in charge here, you in charge here, you in charge there. But, of course, those states are very fragile. They've only existed for less than 100 years,
I think,
they could be gone by the end of World War III.
Michael Hudson's main point, in a way, is that there is absolutely no point in making any agreement with the United States because they've clearly broken them in the past, and if they fancy some part of the agreement, then they just get the Israelis to do it for them.
Well, the other thing we haven't mentioned is the Israelis are spoilers on any agreement that you might make. Yeah. So, in other words, if you made an agreement, the Israelis will just say, well, we're just not going to go along with that. And, of course, the Iranians are pretty clear. They want a ceasefire in Lebanon, and they want, you know, they're not just going to deal with their own stuff. They're not going to walk away from the people
in
Lebanon.
So, I mean, they've annexed South Lebanon, haven't they now, the Israelis, pretty much?
Well, they're trying to, but the Hezbollah are actually doing a very good job of killing Israeli soldiers, which, of course, is the business. kill them, soldiers. They've got 200 Merkava tanks. The Hezbollah have killed 100 of those tanks. Half the Israeli tank force is already out of action.
Do you think that this conflict in the Middle East with the United States, Israel and Iran and their various allies like Yemen, etc., has any real relation to the Ukraine-Russia conflict?
Well, they're all
commentators are talking about this being all really part of the same struggle.
Well, they're all linked, because the linkage is the attempt by the US to retain its hegemonic role in world affairs.
But the United States has backed off from Russia.
No, they haven't. They're still supplying weaponry to the Ukrainians.
I thought the Europeans were now taking
the Europeans are supposedly doing it as well. The point is that war isn't over. And, of course, there's a threat tomorrow that the Ukrainians may attack the victory parade in Moscow for the, you know, May 9th remembrance of the Second World War. And Putin has made it clear if they do that, then he's going to pulverise downtown Kyiv. He's going to knock out, they're going to go after the leadership in, because they haven't done that so far. They've ignored, they've basically allowed the political leadership in Ukraine to function so that they could perhaps do a deal with them. August, but if they attack the parade tomorrow, they say, well, we're going to whack you really, really hard.
I'm going to
be looking to kill you.
August 1942 was the horrific Canadian raid on Dieppe. That's something I'm going to be talking about on Sunday with Matt Eret. Now, this was very important in the Second World War, in my view, because after this December 1941, and the Americans and the Russians by then were both in against Germany in the Second World War, is Stalin very quickly into 1942 was saying, well, look, hey guys, you know, we're doing all the fighting now. You started this war, but we're actually losing. And I think, isn't it 27 million that the Russians lost in World War II? So they were losing their people at a very, very fast rate in the Second World War, which is what tomorrow's parade is really all about, the Russian victory. You know, in a way, the Americans and the British were peripheral, actually, to that victory. And they were saying that we want you to open up the Western Front, weren't they? And this is, Stalin was saying, well, look, hang on, we're doing all this fighting on our own at the moment. You're not even on the continent.
Yes, and of course there was suggestions that they waited until the Russians had done most of the fighting, but then they got into D-Day and
another 2 years before D-Day,
to make sure that they couldn't just take over.
So the Russians were fighting, I think, unnecessarily, really. I mean, if you think about, the Dieppe was an attempt by the British to send a signal to Stalin, look, we've had a go at trying to invade the continent by sea to do
It was only supposed to be a raid. It was never a proper invasion.
No, but it was such a horrific disaster.
It was a disaster, but it was only supposed to be a raid. I mean, there wasn't enough troops to make a pretense.
They weren't trying to invade. No, they were trying to do a raid, but it was a particularly horrific one with something like 3,000, I think it was 3,000 Canadian soldiers killed. It was almost entirely Canadian. But as we know, the agent, John Ainsworth Davis, had been sent over to pre-warn the German high command that this raid was taking place. So this is, I think, very important aspect to the Second World War, is that whole business wasn't a surprise attack at all. And the fact that that raid was not involving very many British soldiers, but it was involving lots of Canadian soldiers, to me, this is just a way of pretending to try and open a second front, or to send a very strong message to Stalin. Look, you're going to have to go on your own, because we can't amass an invasion force.
It was more complicated than that, as you know, because John Ainsworth Davis had basically been he was basically supposedly a traitor to the British cause. He wasn't, but the British, in fact, in order to protect his identity and for him to be seen,
they were building his cover the German high command.
So in other words,
so he stood up on the cliff top at Dieppe.
Yes,
it's at 3 o'clock in the morning,
yes.
And the SS had apparently a piano wire around his neck, saying to him, "Look, if they don't arrive by 6 a.m., you're going over that cliff."
Yes.
Cliff.
So in other words,
they did arrive.
In order to protect his identity and to his cover, 3,000 Canadian soldiers were sacrificed by Churchill. That's what happened. And of course, in the long run, as you know, John Ainsworth Davis was involved in extracting Martin Bormann from Berlin, and then the British intelligence services spirited him away to Argentina.
So you can see why the Russians might be a little bit annoyed about what's been going on in Ukraine.
Well, I mean, the Russians are very well aware that what the West did at the end of the Second World War was they basically integrated, the whole German high command was basically re-employed by NATO. And the Russians could see that.
And I think also...
Of course, in the areas of Eastern Europe that the Russians controlled, they pretty systematically...
They were facing, Cold War, they were facing exactly the same people.
That's right. And of course, modern Russians are very well aware that the people behind what's going on are the same people that they were fighting in the 1940s.
How do you mean? They must be dead by now.
Well, no, I'm talking about the continuity here in the
policy. So who are those people?
Well, I mean, Reinhard Gehlen, for example, who was the head of the Gestapo, becomes the head of the BND, which is the West German Intelligence Services. Now, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes for the Russians to work that out. You know, so you've just taken him over. Yeah.
Yeah, when I was on the island of Patmos many, many years ago, there was a big piece of graffiti there saying NATO equals Nazi. So this is, I think, what the Russians are thinking.
People in Greece will be well aware of that. Because, of course, the Greek Civil War, the British crushed the El Aselam, which was the communist guerrilla movement. And Stalin let them do it because he was basically allowed to have Poland. Yeah, so... The British crushed the communists in Greece, and Stalin crushed the pro-Western forces in Poland because they were dividing the world up between them at that stage.
Well, it's all very nasty for the Poles, who we said we were going into Second World War to help, and then we just abandoned them to Moscow.
Well, there's not a lot we could have done about it.
Maybe there is nothing we could have done about it once they've occupied that country.
I mean, Poland. And all these other East European countries, some have less hostile relations with Russia. But at the end of the day, you've got to get on with your neighbours because you're going to be there forever. So, you know, the Iranians have to get on with the Saudis, and the Saudis have to get on with the Iranians because that's where they are.
Well, maybe the Ukrainians have to get on with the Russians. Anyway, tomorrow is the big parade day, and I found it fascinating that the Russians have decided they're going to switch off all of their mobile data networks tomorrow.
We are in downtown Moscow. It's around a 7-minute drive to Red Square from here, and mobile internet is down. My phone is showing some bars, but nothing loads. The Kremlin says this is for security reasons.
It is clear that internet access restrictions are inconvenient for many, but such is the situation at the moment.
So why shut off mobile internet? Russian authorities believe that drones are using it for navigation. This high-rise residential building was hit by a Ukrainian drone just days ago, ripping out chunks of several elite apartments. Despite layers upon layers of air defenses around Moscow, some Ukrainian drones still make it through. Having no mobile internet is something the Russian capital and other regions are starting to get used to. This was the case for weeks on end in March. Now, we've asked several dozen stores and cafes around here how it's been affecting them. They say they have fiber optical Wi-Fi now to continue working. However, it has been disrupting the work of some smaller businesses that have mobile terminals because they went offline, as well as the work of thousands of drivers and couriers around the city.
There's no internet. It's hard to communicate, but at least I know my way around the city, so I can do it offline. It's a bit annoying still.
For a city hundreds of kilometers away from the front lines, these mobile internet outages, as well as the occasional drone, are a reminder that the war is real. These measures come just days ahead of President Vladimir Putin hosting his annual military parade for the 9th of May. However, this year, tanks and other hardware will not be rolling through Red Square, again, due to security concerns. Dmitry Medvedenko, Al Jazeera, Moscow.
Thanks again, Al Jazeera. Now no longer on Freeview, but you can watch it. I watch it. It's an extremely good little channel. Martin, it's interesting how they're not only scaling back the actual parade itself, but they've just thrown the switch on the mobile data services. Now, this seems to me like a very sensible move.
Well, you mean that they will be doing what they think is necessary to keep everybody
drones,
safe?
Amazing, isn't it? Drones using... See, they're saying it's actually okay. With Wi-Fi, it's fine because it's got a limited range. But the mobile data has got a much, much bigger range, and therefore... we think the Ukrainians and the British, whoever else is up to these tricks, is using it to draw, to steer the drones.
That's right. And of course, once the parade's over, they may decide that they can restore internet. But of course, in Iran, of course, they've taken the internet down completely, just since the war began. All of these things, you know, people take for granted all of these things. And of course, once this real war gets going, all things that people take for granted may be gone. Yeah. We might have our internet removed in this country, for example.
I remember down at the, I think, is it Blandford Forum, going to the British Army Signals Museum down there and being given a fantastic little talk. In fact, it may even be up on our page, one of my documentary pages that I put up over the years, to the British Army. Apparently the British Army invented mobile data services, and the idea was that you needed a microwave driven radio system to deliver maps to soldiers in the field, and this is how mobile data first started many years ago. And now, of course, it's been rolled out into civilian use, but it seems to me as if it's had a British military origin.
Well, I mean, that may well be so. I mean, you know, Everything we have now has been built on the shoulders of people who went before us and pioneered all these technologies.
The military seem to be quite good at developing these technologies, so I think it's quite feasible the Russians are right, and that that the Ukrainians are using Russian mobile data networks to drive their drones.
What they're concerned about is Zelensky has specifically threatened that he's going to attack the parade. And the Russians have said, if you do that, we are going to attack you.
Because you can actually use the mobile data network to send pictures back about where the drone is.
Well, that's right. So in other words,
steer it into dirty work.
The Israelis have been using the Internet of Things in Lebanon in order to track down people that they want to kill. So in other words, they've got access to all sorts of CCTV cameras, everything, you know, that they can hack into it.
You know what? You can even, most washing machines you buy now have actually internet access into
them. That's right. So in other words, there's a surveillance, and you know, it's part of modern warfare is to use the existing internet structure
if you were a particularly evil person, you could say, right, he's just turned on the washing machine, quick stick a drone through the window now.
That's right, yeah. I mean, they can do it, and because in the past they could have collected all this information, but they wouldn't have been able to process it.
Is this called total information awareness? I think it might be, actually.
Yeah. So in other words, that's
with that Illuminati eye in the pyramid when that came out 9/11, just after 9/11.
The war in the Ukraine has tested both sides' abilities for electronic warfare to the limit. Mm. And of course, what Hezbollah are using now in South Lebanon are these, they're fiber optic drones, yeah? So they run on a lot of fiber optic cables.
It might be about time that we just banned AI and banned internet, because a lot of this technology relies on these things to kill.
Yes, I know, but if you ban it, how are you going to ban it? The technology's out there, and war fighting aspects of that technology are all being used as we speak.
If someone is transmitting a signal, then you know, these mobile phone companies will just have to either turn off their transmitters or whatever. Anyway, look, what about the bigger picture with Russia? How's that all going? I think obviously Scott Ritter is one of the best people to let us know how that war is progressing. He thinks Putin is doing extremely well.
First of all, if you focus on what's happening on the battlefield, you understand that Russia is completely committed to winning a war of attrition, a war of attrition that, you know, isn't designed to have the Russians. This isn't the Yankees versus the Confederacy where the Union's willing to lose everybody. This would be a war of attrition with the, you know, with the Yankees saying we want to minimize casualties while we maximize Confederate casualties. That's the Russian approach. And it's working. Why does Russia need to do that? Because Russia isn't going to sacrifice its economy. Its economy, people tend to forget that Russia was subjected to, you know, stringent sanctions that were designed to buckle the Russian economy. The goal of the U.S. European sanctions program was to terminate the viability of Russia's economy. Russia's done the exact opposite. Russia has not only stabilize their economy is thriving, but they only thrives because you're not sacrificing all of your manpower in Ukraine, because you are allocating significant resources to sustaining civilian, commerce. It's the genius of the Russian system. So those people who say Russia's not fully focused means you haven't a clue what's going on, because if Russia had done what everybody said they should have done, their economy wouldn't be doing what it's doing today. Which is successful. And it's not just that the civilian side of the economy, Russia's outperforming the world in defense industry. The Russians have taken the defense industry that was largely dormant and have activated, brought it up to wartime functioning, and are pumping out missiles and tanks and everything else in numbers that people can't even imagine. It's not just about supporting what's going on in the special military operation. This is about Russia rebuilding their military, going from 900,000 to 1.6 million to over 2 million. Now, when you increase the numbers of troops that way, they need equipment. Where's that equipment coming from? From the factories that are not only supplying a war of attrition, which means you're taking casualties, but building new formations, not with just the first frontline order, but to sustain combat. Russia knows what it means. Once you engage, you have to have the missiles, the artillery shells, the fuel and everything stockpiled up to keep the war going. Russia is doing this. We're the side that has nothing left. We're the side that has our armories emptied. The Russians know what they're doing. So when people say, does Putin have the commitment to do this?
Well, I mean, Scott Ritter obviously got military background. He used to be a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Marines, and weapons inspector in Iraq. And he's, you know, his analysis is solid. There's such a lot of disinformation and downright loopiness in European capitals about what's going on in the Ukraine. I mean, lots of people have woken up to the war in Iran being a crazy misadventure, but there's still quite a lot of people across the political spectrum in this country who seem to think that the war in Ukraine is somehow justified from our point of view. It isn't. Ukraine is flat, but it's very similar to Yugoslavia in that there is not just one homogenous population there. There never has been. The people who live in the East Ukraine are Russians. They speak Russian. They're Russian Orthodox people. They are not Ukrainian, which is why they don't want to be in the Ukraine, which is what this is all about.
Well, what was it called? I think about it as Epstein Freedom, isn't it? Something else, wasn't it? This operation.
It was called Epic Fury.
Oh, Epic Fury. It's Epstein Fury, right. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, it seems to have been, as various commentators, and this isn't me saying this, that it's actually the problems with the Gulf states that have forced the Americans to pause things a bit.
Well, that's right, because this has all been war-gamed out by the Americans years ago. I mean, de Kuyper, who was a US Marines commander, he played the Iranians in a war game, and he did exactly what they're doing now. And he said, you're not going to beat them. They're on their home turf. They've got everything they need to beat us. And every time we've war-gamed it out, we lose. But Trump was persuaded by Netanyahu that the military, who basically knew what they were doing, were wrong, and that if Trump, you know, genius that he is, overrode his generals and decided to have an attack anyway, that it would all work out fine. It hasn't worked out fine. It's worked out as predicted, with the Americans getting a serious bloody nose. And of course, the more they carry on, the more bloody nose they're going to get.
Well, it does seem as if I've been looking at all these videos from the Iranians. They're songs, basically, aren't they?
They've got their own comms teams. You know, they're designed for people to swap around on phones, aren't they? Short, sharp, focused, funny videos.
It's called Explosive Media.
Yeah.
If you want to find them, YouTube, it's Explosive Media videos. Some of them are better than others, but they've decided to go for this sort of Lego look as well, haven't
That's
they?
Right. I mean, this is all, you know, modern warfare is partly cognitive, yeah? You try and persuade people of what you're doing while you're doing
it. Many of our homegrown American, British, European stars were over in New York doing some sort of big gala dinner last week, and you look at them and you think none of you are making any music which even touches some of this Iranian stuff.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's
the dumbing down of the Western music. But I mean, the music business always was a bit of a business, but it seems to me that many of the decent voices are shut out of the music business nowadays. It's another clique.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the way the Western media bubble works is very, very insidious. And people do not realise how partial the view of the world they are getting is. But of course, with the internet, it's possible to find other voices. The Iranians are communicating directly with the US general public, and they're trying to speak to them without being mediated by the Western media bubble. And
there's one called,
I don't think they've expected anything like that.
There's one called Screaming for Peace by this Explosive Media Videos group, and I'll put that on the tail end of the show, thisweek.org.uk, onto the podcast. I think maybe we should just have a little look at what's been going on with the Israelis. We've had a flotilla that's been raided by Israel too this week. I mean, this is, I look at the young people on the flotilla and I think, wow, what heroes. You know, you and I are in our 60s, Martin.
There's quite a lot of elderly people on the flotilla. But I mean,
I look at them, I think, look at these wonderful young people who are prepared to risk their lives to get medicine and food to the beleaguered and massacred and genocided people in Gaza. But they're still prepared to do it. I think there was something like, I think, 30 or 40, several hundred individuals all raided and arrested on the international waters by the Israelis.
That's right. It's a completely illegal act. Yeah, they're in international waters. They're not supposed to do that. Of course, if they tried to sail into Gaza, they would do that because they say we're controlling this area. But in actual fact, Gaza's waters belong to the Palestinians. They don't belong to the Israelis. And of course, it's just keeping the pressure up. And of course, the Palestinians are still being starved, still being bombed. There's no real ceasefire.
And the British government is complicit.
Thiago Avila winces as he takes a seat in court. The Brazilian environmentalist was on board the Global Sumud flotilla, sailing with humanitarian aid destined for Gaza, intent on breaking Israel's blockade. The court ordered his detention be extended by 2 days, along with another activist, Saif Abu Keshek, a Spanish national. They haven't officially been charged. Israel claims the pair are affiliated with the Popular Conference for Palestinians Abroad, a group designated by Israel and the U.S. as a terrorist organization. The flotilla, carrying more than 170 activists, set sail on April the 12th from Spain and France, regrouped in Sicily, and then departed 2 weeks later. Within 2 days, the large contingent of 58 vessels reached the eastern coast of Crete. On the night of April the 29th, Israeli naval forces intercepted 22 boats in international waters. The Israeli Navy transferred the activists onto Greek boats who disembarked at a port in Crete, where they were processed and deported, all except for two. Lawyers for the pair detail the treatment they say their clients have endured at the hands of Israeli authorities.
Both of them were subjected to torture and violence since the moment they were abducted by the Israeli Navy.
There's been widespread outrage at Israel's actions, with protests popping up in several countries demanding the release of the activists. And the wife of Abu Keshek is making this appeal.
To mobilize, to protest in front of the embassies, keep talking about the flotilla, keep talking about Saif and Thiago, keep talking about Palestine.
The Spanish Prime Minister has lashed out at the Israeli government.
Now that Netanyahu has done this, abducting foreign citizens, one of them is Spanish, and taking him to Israel, I say several things to Prime Minister Netanyahu. The first is that Spain will always protect its citizens.
Lawyers and organizers of the flotilla argue Israel has no jurisdiction over foreign citizens seized in international waters more than 900 kilometers from the shores of Gaza. Michael Apple, Al Jazeera.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit cheeky of them, isn't it? A bit more piracy. Maybe they're friends with the Americans, eh?
Well, I mean, this is we're in a situation where international law is being openly flouted by the most powerful states within the international
system. One of the reasons,
system.
Of course, that they're actually arresting these people and detaining them is because they're actually extremely articulate. They will go straight onto the press and they'll be talking all about what's happened to them. It's very convenient that the Israelis have stuck these. You know, let's imagine that they were Brits when they come back to Britain. Quite likely that the campaigners in London will stick them on an open-top bus and they'll drive around as heroes.
Well, obviously, what's happening is a polarisation of public opinion around all of this.
But they'll get the crowds.
Well, I think the popular opinion...
Those that have been serving in the Israeli army, Martin, won't get the crowds. These guys will.
No, they won't. But at the same time, if you look at politics in Britain, you will see everybody, Keir Starmer and everybody to his right, Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage, are all lining up behind the Israeli genocide. They are. And that is obviously the opinion of some people in this country, but they're very much a minority.
A tiny minority. So we're not a democracy. Funny that. Americans have asked, this is on Ynet News, an Israeli, I think that's an Israeli one, isn't it? Yeah. US has asked Turkey to stop another Gaza flotilla. 60 vessels are about to set sail from Turkey. So Israel has asked Washington to ask Turkey. This is how it works. To stop 15 ships from joining the Sumud flotilla. This is just yesterday. Which has already been grabbed by the Israelis. Amidst fears this new flotilla could turn violent, similar to the Mavo Marmara incident, which 9 passengers were killed by the Israelis. So that's if the Israelis decide they want it to turn violent. So a week after the Israeli Navy stopped a flotilla that set sail from Spain, Israel is trying to thwart another one before it sets sail.
Yes, and of course the people in these flotillas know very well that they're unlikely to be allowed through. But what they are doing is keeping the pressure up of public opinion on the Israelis.
And isn't it interesting how so as these people are released, they fly back home, then they maybe will be starting another flotilla straight away.
That's right. I mean, we are going to be protesting tomorrow here in Bristol at midday at the bandstand in Castle Park. And this war is hard, you know, it's not over. In many respects, it looks as if it's hardly started. And we're going to all have to play our part, aren't we, in what's going
to It's very difficult to just
up.
Say, no, I'm not involved, I can't get involved. At some point, this is going
to
come. This
is going to
come
gonna
right
be
onto
it.
Your doorstep.
Yes,
it's
everybody in the whole world is going to be affected by this directly
and
or indirectly.
And I think the longer people just leave it, don't think, oh, I can't get involved. It's going to come and it will eventually come and get you. And I think that's, in a way, what the Israelis and the Americans rely on is people just being disillusioned, apathy. Oh, well, what can I do? And in fact, the whole world UN system has been really not able to put the Israelis back on its box, Martin, has it?
No. I mean, this is a very, very consequential moment. You don't get this this happens once in a lifetime when something like this comes along. It's going to, the international system is not going to look the same at the end
well,
of the
tunnel.
In fact, many of us, maybe none of us, are going to be here at the end of the tunnel.
We shall see. Anyway, look, one of the best Israeli journalists is a guy called Gideon Levy. He was asked to explain a bit about this. What is the situation? He's saying, what part is Israel going to be playing in the region in the future? He's a little bit worried that Israel itself is putting itself in danger of being gotten rid of itself. You know, it's always moaning that other people want to get rid of Israel. Maybe the biggest force driving the annihilation of Israel is the government itself.
Donald Trump start to understand now that Benjamin Netanyahu pushed him to a war which brought him only damages. He sold him the notion that regime change will be possible within days. It didn't happen, and it's not going to happen under bombardments. And all of a sudden, more and more people start to ask in the United States, in Israel and elsewhere, what was it all about? What was this war in Iran? The nuclear capabilities were not touched. The Hormuz Strait, which was open before the war, is closed. There's no regime change, obviously. Nobody talks about the ballistic missiles and nobody even thinks to negotiate it. What was exactly achieved in this war and what was it about with all the enormous price that it took? So I guess that very soon the blame will be directed at Israel. Rightly or wrongly, the idea is that if Netanyahu went 7 times to Washington in the last year, he had only one goal, and this was to convince Donald Trump to go for this war. If it would have been a success, Donald Trump would be happily taking the full credit about this war. But as it becomes more and more, as it seems to become more and more a horrible fiasco, which complicated the whole region without any benefits to anyone, who got any benefits out of this war? What was improved by this war? Israel is a safer place. United States is a stronger country. I mean, what was achieved there? So the blame game will lead to Netanyahu and to Israel. And I guess that in any case, after Donald Trump, I don't see, would it be a Democrat or Republican? I don't see any American president who will continue the special relations with Israel, with all their implications. And this, in my view, is a major change in the Middle East, because Israel, without the United States, without the unconditional full support, is not the same Israel. And therefore, the Middle East will not be the same Middle East.
Well, I mean, that's a kind of voice of sanity from Israel. Obviously, he doesn't represent the mainstream
opinion.
Well,
he's giving us another reason why this war has been a massive international game changer, potentially, in that we've just been hearing about the Gulf states thinking, well, actually, maybe we should just throw our lot in with the Iranians a bit more and a little bit less with the Americans, steering over away from the petrodollar hypnosis that's been going for sort of 70 years or so. And now also the possibly, he says, the politics in the United States may be shifting with people realizing. I think it wasn't it George W. Bush when he was talking about bin Laden. I think it was bin Laden he was talking about, wasn't it? He said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, you can't get fooled again. What he really
That was George W. Bush.
Yeah, that's right. George W. Bush said this. But actually, what he really meant was he was trying to say, well, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So Trump is now going down this road of realizing, well, maybe that whole business of regime change is a total con. Do you think Trump might internalize that as an individual and think, I'm not trusting Netanyahu again?
I think the problem is that Netanyahu has got blackmail compromat on him. This is the reality.
So he's not really got a choice.
He hasn't got a choice. Because, of course, we haven't really discussed the Epstein files. But, I mean, they've been, the third of those files haven't been released. And all the evidence suggests that there's plenty about Trump in those files. Now, that's all you need to know. Because all of the money that he was given to be elected by Miriam Adelson and all these other Zionist tech billionaires. And of course, Trump's family are actually making money out of all this stuff. So every time he tweets, he tells his sons what's going on, and they just go and buy and sell shares on the back of it. It's absolutely blatant theft. That's what it is. And of course, Trump
isn't that bothered, really.
No, he's not. Well, yes, and of course, he can't turn around now, because the Israelis have got too much on him, and the Israelis are the real wild card, because they irrational as it is, they want to have the war escalated. Now, they'll probably lose if they escalate, which is why they shouldn't do it, but they're not necessarily rational. People like Smotrich and all the others, they really are millenarians, you know. They see this as the opportunity to, you know, once in a lifetime to, you know, get the greater Israel they've always wanted. Now, of course...
Well, there was an irrationality about Hitler attacking Russia in 1941.
That's right.
Barbarossa, everyone was telling him, don't do it.
In warfare... you know, there's plenty of evidence of people doing stupid stuff. You can't presume that people who are fighting battles are actually that as clever as they think they are.
Or the ones making the decisions, never mind the fighting.
They often make mistakes. There's a huge, long history of military blunders.
Maybe they need a bit more wisdom in the United States. Do you think in the cabinet?
They don't really do wisdom, do they?
Well, they may be doing wisdom, Martin. I don't know if you know,
Jeffrey
but Marco
Sachs
Rubio,
wisdom, but
Marco
he's, but he's not,
Rubio
not power,
is just
is
going
he?
To visit the Pope. Maybe you'll get a little bit of wisdom from the Pope.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is visiting the Vatican today. Rubio says he met with the Pope to underscore our shared commitment to promoting peace and human dignity. President Trump has criticized Pope Leo for speaking out against the war with Iran. The Pope says he's simply preaching the gospel. Now a new ABC News, Washington Post, and Ipsos poll shows two-thirds of Americans had a positive reaction to Pope Leo's call for peace. The Pope's official biographer, Crux Senior Rome correspondent Elise Ann Ellen is here for more on all of that. Hi, Elise. Thanks for coming on.
Hello. It's good to be with you. Thank you so much.
So how significant is this meeting between the Pope and the Secretary of State?
This is an incredibly significant meeting that happened today. You know, this is the first high-level meeting that the Pope has had with a member of the U.S. administration since his inauguration, basically. And obviously, there have been some tense moments since then. So what happened today, I think, was a very significant conversation that could be really decisive in terms of the direction that things take, or at least the tone of interaction between, you know, the Holy See and the United States in the coming weeks and months. Obviously, they have very differing opinions on peacemaking and, you know, what peace looks like and how to achieve that. But I think the great hope is that they will at least reach, you know, more civil, you know, discourse, you know, more civil interaction as, you know, these debates unfold.
Our new poll shows 41% of Americans have a favorable opinion of the Pope and 16% unfavorable. What do you make of those numbers for the first American Pope?
Well, I think at a very basic level, I think the fact that he is the first American Pope says a lot about his favorability. You know, people, I think, are just inclined to like Leo. You know, I have done two tours now presenting my book in the United States, and there is just an overwhelming emotion and excitement over Pope Leo. People's, you know, interest in him is sort of insatiable. People want to know who he is. They want to understand what he's about. And I think that they have a very positive reaction to this messaging of peace that he has carried forward since the day of his election. He's made it clear that he wants to be a Pope of peace. Those are the first words that he uttered on the balcony of St. Peter's, you know, after his election. Peace be with you. He's made it clear that that is going to be a key part of his agenda. And I think it's a call that a lot of people are very receptive to.
So 1700 years on, the first American Pope, and Rubio is over there. So they're having a nice little chit chat.
Well, I mean, there's obvious tension there between what Trump thinks the Pope should be doing and what Pope Leo thinks he should be doing.
I'd say World War III is just about to break out, and we get the first American Pope giving the so-called Christian point of view in all of this.
Well, it's not the so-called Christian point of view. I think he's absolutely... All he's doing is, as he says...
Well, the Vatican, you know...
Yes, I know, but I mean, the organised religion is organised religion.
Well, he's going to say certain things.
There's going to be a Pope, so he's the one, and he's saying, you know, I think
it's Pete Hegseth that needs to have a little chit-chat with the Pope.
Well, I mean, when does the Pope want to talk to him?
You know? Well, of course, but the Pope wants to talk to everybody, Martin, being a good Christian.
Yes.
He loves everybody, even the Satanists. He invites them to the Vatican.
Well, anyway, we'll have to see what happens with all of this. I think it's annoying. I mean, at one stage, they were threatening that Trump was saying we could get a different Pope. I could get you got rid of, and we could have, you know, he was mentioning Avignon, where the French crown had a sort of anti-pope created in Avignon, which they could control. And Trump was saying, well, if he doesn't do what I want, I'm going to get rid of him. And it's like, that is arrogance, incredible arrogance, to imagine that you know, with your landslide election victory, which was less than 50% of the vote, you're in a position to tell the world's Catholics who can be the Pope. That's how delusionary he is.
Really?
Well, he is delusionary. Really,
I mean, surely he's saying this, that these are little memes he chucks out there, like this love tap, you know, for one of our missile strikes.
Well, I mean, he's grotesque. If you think of all the suffering that's being inflicted on innocent people by his behaviour, it's grotesque. It's appalling.
In Mali, things have been going on in Mali, haven't they? Yeah. Let's just sort of round up our international look. And this looks to me like the West trying to fight back against the Russians successfully being the superpower that's now backing the Mali government.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it looks like the Ukrainians have been training the jihadist terrorists in Mali.
Well, Al-Qaeda's getting involved. Anyway, let's have a listen to Al Jazeera.
Kanyaroba prison is about 60 kilometers on the outskirts of the capital, Bamako. It's considered or dubbed by many Malians as the African Alcatraz. Why? Well, because it houses around 2,500 detainees, some of them dangerous ones. There are 70 of them that are high-profile prisoners. And the Al-Qaeda affiliate, Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, targeted this prison because some of those detained are fighters of the group. Meanwhile, they continue to hold a blockade surrounding the capital, Bamako. That's a city that's roughly the size of Barcelona, and there's only 6 or 7 arteries that leave the capital. Now, Al-Qaeda fighters have set up checkpoints using motorcycles mounted with 12.7mm machine guns, and they've managed to stop these food trucks coming from Morocco through neighboring Mauritania and set them ablaze. Food trucks that were set on fire in a country where the UN says people are dying of hunger. There are reports of villages that are not in the capital Bamako, but are severed from the capital Bamako that rely on that transit area. In the Mopti region, where people have been suffering from drought that rely on food coming from the outside.
There have also been worrying reports of hunger. On the 3rd of May, the mayor of Jafarabe village in the Mopti region called on the authorities to act within 48 hours or people would start dying of hunger.
They need urgent humanitarian assistance, but currently that is not possible because of the Al-Qaeda blockade. Nicholas Hawke, Al Jazeera, Dakar.
What the wider story here is that the destruction of Libya by NATO in the 90s, or not the 90s, in 2011, has basically allowed the resurgence of Al-Qaeda in sub-Saharan Africa. And they are being encouraged by the Western powers because they do not want the Russians to get a foothold there. The Russians are getting a foothold there because these new governments, which are being led by young soldiers in that region, want to get out from the French control of their economies for many years, and they see these insurgents as essentially being pushed by the West. Now, people in the West don't really get this because we've had such a lot of propaganda about Islamist terrorists this, Islamist terrorists that. In the rest of the world, it's well understood that Islamist terrorism is in effect a proxy army for Western powers.
I think we ought to say where Mali is. So it's in, with the whole sort of northwest Africa, a great big bulge at the top of Africa. Mali's smack bang in the middle of there. It borders, it doesn't have a sea border, but it borders onto Mauritania, which does, on the left, which is another massive country. There are several sort of small ones and some big ones. Mali's one of the biggies. Burkina Faso is also bordering south of Mali, and then you go down to the coast, it's Nigeria, Ghana, Liberia, Guinea, places like that, Togo. So there must be masses and masses of natural resources in Mali. It's quite a prize for one of the superpowers if the Russians can persuade the locals that they're going to be better bosses than the Yanks.
Well, that's what happened. At one stage, the French and the Americans had their troops in these. I think it was in Mali or Burkina Faso.
The French, I think, had to leave, didn't they?
Yeah, and then the Russians arrived Because then
wasn't it Wagner?
Wagner arrived, and then they kicked the Americans or the French out, and then they took over where they. Now, of course, this is like the great game of risk that's going on all over the planet. What's happening is that the U.S. empire, because it is an empire, that's how it functions. The whole purpose of what they've set up is to get countries like Mali into debt so that they have to pay that debt. And by paying that debt, they're running down their own country.
So if the Russians are in charge, does that mean they won't have to pay the debt?
Well, what Hudson is suggesting, we've heard from earlier, is that at a certain point, countries will not be able to pay their debts. It's not a question of whether they want to. Mm. They won't be able to. And then they will default. These defaults
so this
will run through the whole system and bring the banking system down.
This neo-colonial policy is running out of road then.
Well, that's right. They could have negotiated. If you had a more rational kind of leadership in the US, they could be talking rationally to the Russians and the Chinese about how we could all work together to try and do whatever we want to do. But they're determined not to give up their pole position. They've got used to the idea that they tell everybody else what to do and the whole world's got to jump. And Trump, of course, very much epitomises that kind of attitude. And, of course, what they've done is they've ripped up the textbook on free market economics. Yeah. So all that stuff about Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, we've got a market economy, blah, 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 blah. And as soon as US's national interests are threatened, they just rip all that up and say, we're going to put tariffs on you. We're going to blockade you. We're going to fire missiles at you. We're going to sink your fishing boats. It's absolutely in your face gangsterism. And of course, at the end of that, there's going to be a big fight.
Yeah, well, the
fight.
Thing is, when the gangsters are in town, Martin, what everyone does is they say, is there anyone sensible? And they start talking to them instead.
Well, that's one of the things that they're doing. But also, of course, the warfare is warfare. The Ukrainian army has lost perhaps 1.7 million casualties. That's a very serious number. Yeah, this is big. And, of course, it's only just got going. Yeah, there could be millions more to die.
That's actually considerably more than the British lost in World War II.
That's right.
I think it was 750,000,
yes,
I think we
that's
lost.
Right. So in other words, this is all getting very, very...
Twice as many.
And of course, I mean, the people in Gaza, there must be... I mean, the proper estimate of the dead is probably in around 800,000, something like that. And it's just... This is the most dangerous point since 1945.
And the people in charge are absolutely
Where
do you think
feckless.
Is the most dangerous flashpoint, Ukraine or Iran?
Well, Iran's more dangerous in the short run because that can bring down the world economy. Yeah, the Ukraine war will grind on and the Russians will eventually get what they want, but it's not going to escalate unless there is another escalation. Because
anyway,
of course, what's happening now is they're allowing drone attacks through the Baltic states onto the St. Petersburg region, and the Russians are getting fed up with this. You can't just allow the Ukrainians to use your airspace to attack us. Otherwise, we're going to fly back.
Mm. So anyway, all over the news this week has not been what Martin's just talking about there. It's been something called the MV Hondius.
The what?
MV Hondius. A cruise ship with about 200 people on board. Mm. Anyway, before we hear your views on this very, 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 very important. Well, for about 3 days we were being told how terrible this was and everyone's comparing it to COVID. And then on the fourth day they started saying, oh, we mustn't compare it to COVID. Well, this is how the national news media messes with your mind. Someone who's a little bit more sensible on these things is a chap called Dr. David Halpin.
I watched television tonight, the main news, Hunter virus and the cruise ship, about 20, I imagine about 10 minutes, 12 minutes. They showed a map of the dispersal of the various people who they're trying to trace, contact trace. There was a map showing some people getting off of St. Helena. They're aiming for the Canaries, and they showed two or three people in the Canaries, locals, objecting to the ship landing there, and risking their health. They said you should go to a main European port like Spain. Someone was taken to Holland, as you know. Others were being, and they were talking the HS security agency is involved, as you might know. But there's quite a lot of dispersal. And it reminded me of what I wrote in regard to Ebola. They remember there was a lady in a West African country who was in contact with local native people who had Ebola and were being buried rapidly because it was apparently an epidemic. We all that needs investigating too. But this woman, who was a nurse, I think, or I know she was a charity worker, I think, she was brought back on a plane. She changed planes, I think, in Morocco, and then she joined the plane to go to Heathrow. And the whole thing was a nonsense. She was, in fact, and then when she got to Heathrow, she was hospitalized. I remember all this now. She's come back to me. She was taken to the Royal Free Hospital, was put in a plastic tent, treated with great precaution as being an infected. She got better. She's since married, and she's had twins. She's healthy. But she went through the mill. Now, that case, that lady, she was not managed properly. It was almost as if they had designed it that she came into contact with the majority of people on the plane. They were being dispersed through Europe. So what's happened with the Hunter virus on his cruise ship that's been down to Antarctic reminds me very much of how the Ebola thing was dealt with.
That's Dr. David Halpin pointing out that it does seem as if there's not been a lot of a proper procedure going on here. They're now trying to contact trace various people who've been running away from this ship. But then we're also being told that you can't catch this through one-to-one human contact, that you have to be around people for long periods of time to have any chance of picking it up.
Well, I don't know enough about it. I'm obviously it's interesting to hear what David Halpin's got to say, because he's obviously a medical professional.
Well, what he's saying is that the way that they've been dealing with it is bizarre. I mean, they're now saying that it shouldn't go into one of the ports because the people there object. Now, as he points out later in the interview, I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Back in the day, any ship like this would just raise a yellow flag. We've got some sort of disease on board. It would moor not at the port, but off the coast, and then medical professionals would be sent over to deal with it, and people would be taken off one by one if they didn't have any symptoms.
Well, I presume that would be the rational
thing
to do.
But that's not what they're doing. Apparently, the Spanish government have said that is what should happen, but the locals are all objecting, and the people from the port are saying we're going to refuse to deal. But largely because this has been blown up into this massive international news story. I think one person has died, possibly of this Hunter virus, and various other people are have been isolated, testing to see if they've actually got it. I mean, it seems to me like a hysterical media reaction to a disease which doesn't merit the massive coverage that it's had.
Well, I tend to agree. I mean, but all the other things that are going on this week and all the death and destruction.
Yeah, how many people have died in Ukraine during this week? Anyway, look, there just seems to be a sort of mix-up of priorities in so much of our news media these days. So let's have one of our last reports tonight. We'll be looking at... did you know it was World Press Freedom Day this week?
No.
These journalists in Gaza are marking World Press Freedom Day with a protest. Their sign reads, "Stop killing journalists. With our blood, we write for Palestine. Journalism isn't a crime." Gaza is the most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist. And the Palestinian Media Workers Union says Israel has killed more than 260 journalists in the Strip since October 2023.
All press offices in the Gaza Strip have been destroyed by the Israeli occupation. Therefore, the world, which boasts of press freedom, must look at the Palestinian journalists who have been killed, arrested, and injured, especially as they document what is happening in the Gaza Strip with minimal resources.
During his Sunday Mass, attended by thousands, the Roman Catholic Pope paid tribute to members of the press.
Today marks World Press Freedom Day, sponsored by UNESCO. Unfortunately, this right is often violated, sometimes in a blatant manner and sometimes more covertly. We remember the many journalists and reporters who have fallen victim to war and violence.
From conflict zones to authoritarian states, telling the truth is becoming more dangerous than ever. The Committee to Protect Journalists estimates 130 journalists and media workers were killed last year, many in war and unrest. In most cases, no one has been held accountable for their deaths. The CBJ says Israel was responsible for more than 60% of those killings, with Gaza recording the highest toll in a single conflict. More than 330 journalists are in jail worldwide, often on vague charges related to national security or publishing fake news. About 85 journalists are missing or have been forcibly disappeared, with little or no confirmed information on their fates. Press freedom is under growing pressure globally, driven by censorship, arrests, surveillance, and violence.
So that's another Al Jazeera report. Martin, the problem here is that you look at the toll that's taken on journalists around the world, particularly the over 250 killed in Gaza, which is way above a proportion of, you know, it's quite obvious the Israelis are deliberately killing these people because they're reporting war crimes to the whole world that the Israelis themselves are carrying out. 330 in prison. When you see journalists now, you do wonder, so are you really a journalist or are you just doing propaganda for the empire?
Well, there's plenty of people who claim to be journalists who are in fact doing propaganda for the empire, as you say. And then the real journalists, like the ones in Palestine, who just end up dead, because that's what, you know, that's an occupational hazard of people who are being serious about
journalism.
As we were
hearing last week, there is, it's almost like there's a queue of more people wanting to queue up to do this job, simply because they understand that press freedom must never be allowed to die. If it does, then the Israelis will become even more genocidal.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think people get their courage, don't they, in the terrible circumstances in which these people are living. They've now, you know, you might as well just, you know, do what you've got to do and do the right
thing. Well, Fergal Keane is a BBC journalist. He's got lots of press freedom. He's saying that Iranians fear that the regime, they call it, not the government, it's the regime in Iran, of course, is now more entrenched and ready for revenge. There is no evading the simple fact everywhere that people walk, wherever they drive, whenever they switch on the television, the faces of assassinated leaders and those new rulers dominate the public space. Oh dear, because the little lie that Netanyahu whispered into Trump's ear about regime change will only take a couple of days didn't work. So Fergal Keane is saying this is really terrible for the Iranians now.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of spin in the Western media about how, the, you know, Trump came out with it. They've killed 45,000 unarmed demonstrators. The unarmed demonstrators that we provide weaponry to. Yes, I didn't. Did I mention the weaponry that we supplied them? Yeah, because it's just contradiction. Yeah, they supplied weaponry to the, the uprising inside Iran, and it led to gun battles in the streets with the police and the militia. And then that's presented in the West as a spontaneous uprising against the evil dictatorship. Now, of course, all objective analysis now suggests, and I've spoken to people from Iran who've told me, because they've been in contact with people in Iran, that the population are now solidly behind the government because they've been basically attacked. The Israelis and the US have indiscriminately attacked the ordinary population of Iran, just as the Israelis have been doing all along in Gaza and in Lebanon. So, and of course, at that point, people just say, right, well, let's fight them then.
In terms of press freedom, I think it's quite important, looking at questions like we were hearing from Tim from Defend Our Juries earlier, that there are reporting restrictions being put on cases like this. And even with this principle of a barrister who's trying to defend them in court, now himself being potentially charged and prosecuted for what he said in court. I mean, this is getting really bizarre.
Very sinister.
And so when you're looking at this, what you have to wonder is, I'm just speculating here, trying to hear and put two and two together. We had Matt Kennard's story last week, didn't we, about this secret defence agreement between Israel and the United Kingdom. And whilst you can understand if Britain's national security is threatened, that there may be a non-standard way of taking those sorts of prosecutions through the court. So, say, for example, if it's a firebomb which hits the Prime Minister's car or a former car of the Prime Minister, it starts to sound like national security. And quite clearly, you know, you can understand why the authorities might take that more seriously than just a random bombing of a car or arson of a car. But If we've now got, as Matt Kennard is explaining, a secret agreement between Israel and the United Kingdom, could it be that in our courts, our judges, people are whispering in our judges' ear, well, actually, we've got this secret agreement with the Israelis that the threat to Israeli national security is also a threat to British national security. Therefore, you're going to have to up their sentence.
Well, that's quite clearly what's been going on. I don't think there's any dispute about it.
I'm speculating here about that being the cause. It seems a really completely insane idea to have a secret defence agreement with the Israelis that nobody's allowed to know about. I mean, this isn't democratic at all, especially because this is a genocidal regime that this secret agreement is with.
Well, I mean, in the new year, in January, four former British Army generals wrote a letter to Keir Starmer saying we need to cut off all military cooperation with the Israelis immediately. Now, that is certainly not... They're all retired. But, of course, that is not the position of the deep state, of MI6, of, you know, some, you know, the people who are still, who are now running the British military. They basically, I mean, you've got Danet, who used to head the British Army in the House of Lords, super, super pro-Israeli. So it's part of the culture in this, in Britain's military to be pro-Israeli, to be close to the Americans. But of course that means that we are implicated in what's going on, and so is our military. Acre Terre is being used, and US bases in the Gulf are being used by British military personnel to attack Iran. Now, at a certain point, the Iranians are going to lose their temper. You know, if you're going to carry on attacking us, killing our people, we're going to kill some of your people. Because you've got to realise that that's how it works. That's what wars are like.
It's almost as if we're trying to provoke them. Anyway, look, Martin, last week we did talk briefly, didn't we? I'm trying to remember exactly what the context was. You brought it up, actually, was this organisation RSS. Just remind us who they are.
I don't know what it stands for because I can't remember.
I think it's an Indian...
It's an Indian. Well, they were, a fascist aligned movement that grew up in India during the 1930s and have now become very dominant or prominent.
Well, they weren't anything. They are.
Yes.
We hear very little...
The BJP is a wider political force. You know, they're a modest political party, but a lot of the key people in the BJP are RSS, and the RSS was a militarised... You know, they used to have uniforms... They still do. They were, of course, one of their acolytes was the person who killed Gandhi in the run up to Indian independence.
Anyway, so one of the sort of sideshows of all of this is this battle in Pakistan for the actual elected prime minister to be able to rule the country rather than be stuck in jail as Imran Khan has been. And when we interviewed Adil Raja a couple of months ago on here, he mentioned this amazing speech, which I think we had an excerpt, small excerpt from before on this program, by Imran Khan, and I didn't realize it, but he actually spends about 7 or 8 minutes talking about this organization RSS at the United Nations, and it was shortly after this that he was thrown in prison. So I think it's a good idea. Let's have a listen to Imran Khan, who at the time there were all sorts of problems in Pakistan, and he explains at the beginning of his UN talk that, yes, we've got all sorts of problems with Kashmir right now, but I wanted to be here to tell you this about what's actually going on with this organization, the RSS.
Prime Minister Modi told me that, you know, there were terrorist attacks from Pakistan. I said, we have problems with you. There are terrorist attacks which we know are instigated from by India in Balochistan. We caught a spy, Kulbushan Yadav, who admitted what the sabotage going on in Karachi and Balochistan. So we said, look, let's leave that behind. Let's move forward. Our main priority should be our people. The highest number of poor people live in the Indian subcontinent. Unfortunately, didn't make any headways. Our foreign ministers were supposed to meet on this in the UNGA last year. India cancelled it. We thought that it's their election coming up. It's a nationalist, ultra-nationalist party. It doesn't want to cozy up to Pakistan. So we thought, okay, we'll wait till the elections. Meanwhile, a 20-year-old Kashmiri boy, whose father said was radicalized by the security forces in Kashmir, blew himself up on an Indian convoy. Immediately, India blamed us. I spoke to the Indian public on television. I said, if you give us any iota of proof, we will immediately take action because we've clamped down on these groups. Rather than sending us any proofs, they sent their jets in, they bombed us. We retaliated. A jet, two of their planes were shot down, one pilot bailed out in Pakistan. We immediately returned the pilot, saying that, look, we do not want any escalation. Rather than taking that as a peace gesture, the entire campaign, almost the entire campaign of Mr. Modi in the election was how he had taught Pakistan a lesson that they had jets had killed 350 terrorists. Complete lie. They had just killed about 10 trees of ours, which was quite painful given that, you know, we are growing all these trees. The election campaign, Mr. Modi used words like, this is just a trailer, the movie is about to start. I went into Pakistan and taught them a lesson. This was the election campaign. Okay, so we thought, you know, us politicians make all these statements to win elections. So, okay, after elections, we'll get back to our normal relationship. Well, the moment the elections ended, we approached India, no response, but then we discovered they were trying to push us in the fat of blacklist to bankrupt us. That's when we realized there was an agenda. And that agenda became obvious on the 5th August when India went against 11 United Nations Security Council resolutions, which say that the people, Kashmir is a disputed territory and the people of Kashmir have the right of self-determination. They went against that. They went against Simla Accord, which is about bilateral, sorting out our differences through bilateral means, went against that. They actually went against the Indian Constitution. Illegally, they revoked Article 370, which gave Kashmir the special status. They got an extra 180,000 troops there. Total number of security forces in Kashmir now are 900,000. And they put 8 million people of Kashmir under curfew. Mr. President, now I just briefly want to make the people understand, how can anyone do something like this? And for that, I have to explain to you what is RSS. RSS, Mr. Narendra Modi is a life member of RSS. RSS was an organization that was inspired by Adolf Hitler and Mussolini, came about in 1925. They believed in racial purity, racial superiority. They also believed they were an Aryan race like the Nazi believed they were an Aryan race. All that I'm saying can be verified. This is the time of information revolution. You can Google all this, what I'm saying. But it is very important for me to explain this to you so you know what is happening in India. This RSS believed in the ethnic cleansing of Muslims from India. At one point, there was racial superiority of the Hindu race. Secondly, it was hatred for the Muslims and for the Christians because they believed that this golden age of Hindu civilization was stopped because of Muslim rule centuries back and then the British rule of India. So it was racial superiority and hatred for Muslims and Christians. This is openly stated. You look at the founding fathers of RSS, Golwalkar and Savarskar. Just Google them and you'll find out. And this ideology of hate is what murdered the great Mahatma Gandhi in 1948. It was this ideology of hate that made Narendra Modi in 2002 do a pogrom against Muslims in Gujarat when he was the chief minister. He allowed 3 days for these RSS goons who were inspired by the Hitler brown shirts. They actually wear brown shirts. This RSS, the Congress Home Minister gave a statement that in RSS camps, terrorists are being trained. And these terrorists butchered 2,000 Muslims and 150,000 Muslims were made homeless. Narendra Modi could not travel to the US because of that. And I need to make you understand this background before I explain to you that what sort of a mindset would lay siege to 8 million people with 900,000 troops? Women, children, sick people, locked in as animals. In fact, of what I know of England, if 8 million animals were locked in, the RSPCA would have made a lot of noise about it. These are human beings.
So that's Imran Khan speaking, I think it's 2017 or 2018 at the UN General Assembly, Martin, explaining a little bit of the background between this conflict between India and Pakistan, all sorts of dirty tricks, but also brown shirts.
Yes, and of course at one stage Modi was very much persona non grata. He couldn't travel to the US. I think what's happened since then, he's clearly got a substantial level of political support in India. So they've just won in West Bengal, which they previously used to be run by the Communist Party. BJP have managed to take West Bengal. Now, divisive politics can be very successful. Yeah.
Well,
Wasn't it
Mountie that was one of the people that led to this division of, with Kashmir being this sort of grey area between Pakistan and India?
Yes, I mean, there's lots of history there. It's to do with partition and all the rest of it. There are so many flashpoints around the world at the moment. And of course, as we all aware, there's quite likely to be a major economic crisis in India as a result of what's going on in the Gulf. And, of course, Modi allowed the Iranians to send a frigate to participate in a joint exercise in India and then tipped off the Americans where the frigate was. And it was an unarmed frigate. They didn't have any weaponry on it. And then the U.S. sub sank the frigate with killing loads of people on board, and Modi was complicit in that.
So the way that Kashmir is now being run by India is pretty horrific, actually. There's a seminary which is where mullahs are educated. It's basically like a theological college, all completely above board, but the Indian government has said no, this is unlawful, and they're going to shut it down.
Yes. I mean, obviously, what should have happened here, and what the Pakistanis have always been saying, is there should just be a referendum in Kashmir so they can decide what they want to do. They could either join Pakistan or the other possibilities.
Well, that's now been taken out of the Indian constitution.
That's right. But I mean, if it could be that Kashmir could just be an independent country, not part of Pakistan, not part of India. It's big enough.
I think, you know, to me, the reason I do pieces like this, people might think, oh, this is a bit obscure. No, it's the British that left it in this horrible neo-colonial state. And it's part of our responsibility to sort this out.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, we're getting a strain of xenophobic nationalism in England in particular, and it's basically failing to understand that most of the, you know, we were a major empire. We controlled the struggle in Palestine.
Hang on, Martin, don't look. We were the biggest empire the world's ever seen.
Well, that's
actually.
Right. So in other words, a lot of these conflicts around the world, we are implicated in them. We just are. I mean, the whole situation in Palestine is a direct result of British policy.
No, well, the Germans have done actually an excellent job. Deutsche Welle has done an excellent documentary about the RSS. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Almost certainly far more interesting than anything you'll see on the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, etc. Into explaining the ins and outs of the India-Pakistan conflict and this idea of Hindu nationalism, which is actually really a racial superiority cult that's been of brown shirts that's been created over there. So let's have a little dip into that Deutsche Welle documentary now. And this is all to do with the there was an incident at Ayodhya where am I right in saying it was a mosque that was...
There was a historic mosque there which had been there since the 16th century. So it was a very historic building. But the Hindutva extremists, including Modi, believed that it was in fact just like the Israelis believe that the temple has got to be rebuilt. There hasn't been a temple there since 70 AD, but they say so they have to get rid of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and rebuild. That's exactly what happened at Ayodhya. So they besieged the mosque. Eventually, a mob burned it down, the mosque. And now they've rebuilt on top of what used to be the mosque, a brand spanking new Hindu temple to Ram.
Well, imagine in the UK, Stonehenge, right? What happens if, say, the Board of Deputies of British Jews decides it's going to demolish Stonehenge and build a synagogue there?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what we thought. Or maybe we're going to demolish Westminster Abbey and build a, you know...
Well, it's historic, something. Isn't it?
You know, well, that's right.
This mosque has been around for a long time.
That's right. And, of course, it is... they've got away with it. And the Muslims...
Well, have they?
They've destroyed the mosque and they've built something else instead.
But the spin-off is particularly nasty, as Deutsche Welle documentary points out.
That desire to build India grounded in Hindutva nationalism would determine the path taken by Vijay Bahadur Singh. Raised by the RSS worldview, he became deeply involved in Hindu activism and joined a campaign in the early 1990s that reshaped India's political landscape, the Ram Janma Bhoomi movement. At the heart of the movement was Ayodhya, a small town in northern India. It was home to the 16th century Babri Mosque, built during the Mughal era.
The mosque had to be removed. This is Lord Ram's place, and this stain had to be removed no matter what.
For Hindu nationalists, the Babri Mosque became a symbol of historical grievance. Reclaiming the land for a Ram temple became a matter of faith and national pride.
The core demand was now a religious demand. The religious demand with a clear-cut communal angle. You were not just saying we want to build a grand temple to Ram in Ayodhya or somewhere else. You chose something where it was a direct conflict with Muslims.
It sparked fierce debate, not just about religion, but about India's secular foundations and national identity. Campaigners rallied support for the Ram temple. In 1990, BJP leader L.K. Advani traveled across India promoting the message. Backed by the RSS and other Hindu nationalist groups, they mobilized over 100,000 supporters.
The organization felt more and more Ram lovers should reach Ayodhya and show their devotion.
While Hindu hardline foot soldiers like him drummed up religious passions, the BJP had turned it into a mass political movement. That set the stage for the fateful day of December 6th, 1992.
The turning point came when L.K. Advani, who's a senior RSS and BJP leader, later became Deputy Prime Minister. He jumped into the fray and he organized a march. Speeches would be given by people on the way and a lot of mobilization was done. And in fact, Mr. Modi himself was involved in the organization of this Rath Yatra.
The government deployed police officers across Ayodhya, but they were outnumbered by hundreds of thousands of protesters who had descended on the town.
All the borders were sealed. Anyone wearing Hindu symbols like a tilak, a mala, or a kanti was arrested by the police. We jumped over the barricades and did whatever we could. By sunset, all three domes of the mosque were demolished. They were torn down.
The demolition unleashed a wave of communal violence across India, claiming over 2,000 lives, most of them Muslim. But the deeper impact was ideological. It normalized religious polarization and laid the groundwork for future unrest.
So that's part of the documentary I'll put up on our show page this week, .org.uk. It's called India at a Crossroads, 100 Years of Hindu Nationalist RSS Movement by Deutsche Welle, Martin.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty good summary of the problems that India has been facing.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's like they're weaponizing religion. This isn't really a grassroots thing. This is becoming funded by your nationalist political parties, a sort of jingoistic thing.
Well, it is. I mean, these kind of tendencies are to be found all over the world, you know.
Northern Ireland.
Well, all sorts of other places, you know, South Africa, you know, you name it. And of course, when we've got a massive economic crisis, which is what's going to come around the corner soon, probably before the end of the year, all of these pre-existing hostilities and ill feeling could easily be just turned into a huge fire, which would burn us all.
Good time to get rid of juries, eh?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's going to be all sorts of systems and ways of doing things and ideas about politics are going to be tested to destruction in the next period.
Well, yes, it may become like Law of the Jungle, more like. Anyway, talking of that, last week we had quite a discussion about King Charles and his little chit-chat that he had with Donald Trump. But we didn't have a lot of Donald Trump and what he had to say. One of the most, and I think it's just for the record, really, what Trump had to say about his private conversation with King Charles when he was chatting after Charles's speech at Congress. Both of them gave speeches at this White House dinner. And this is where Trump, as the Independent, had an excellent article I put out with last week's show talking about the breach of protocol, because Trump isn't really supposed to talk about what has been said behind closed doors between him and the King.
From the trenches of World War I to the beaches of Normandy, from the frozen hills of Korea to the scorching sands of North Africa and the Middle East. And we're doing a little Middle East work right now, too, if you might know. And we're doing very well. We have militarily defeated that particular opponent. And we're never going to let that opponent ever, Charles agrees with me, even more than I do. We're never going to let that opponent have a nuclear weapon. They know that, and they've known it right now very powerfully. But our countries have stood together, defiant and triumphant against the forces of communism, fascism, and tyranny. Together we have expanded the reaches of human knowledge and endeavored always to make this world safer, more prosperous, more just, and more free.
Well, I mean, it's a extremely self-referential speech, isn't it?
Charles agrees with me even more than I do.
Yes, it doesn't even make sense, does it?
Well, do you think maybe...
How can anybody agree with me more than I do?
Well, I think what he's trying to say there is Charles agrees with this, we mustn't let them enrich any uranium more than I do. I mean, he's just... Yeah, I mean, he's... Anyway, I mean, the point is that I noticed very... I looked at all the various videos of this speech that they both gave, and it was quite, I think, quite devious, really, in that the camera only focused directly onto Donald Trump and Charles as they spoke. And I really wanted to see when he started talking about Charles, Charles agrees with me more than I do about this war and the reasons for the war. To see what Charles's face would look like, you know, and Camilla, and were they going, oh God, what's he saying now? But you can't see it. You're not allowed to see it. So only those people who were in that is it a dinner at the White House or whatever that they had last week, we'll know, was Charles rolling his eyes to heaven, was he covering his face? We will not know that.
I imagine he's just trying to keep a poker face. I don't know whether he succeeded.
Well, unless he was expecting Trump to blow the gaff there. I mean, this is why they do these things, where they only focus on the one person. Yes. So you don't see any reactions.
We're being presented with
It's a bit like
theater.
The House of Commons. You know, one of the most interesting things about the boring stuff that goes on there is to see the reactions of people around the room. And so we're not allowed to see those, despite our wonderful free press. Anyway, look, we're going to finish this evening with... another excerpt from a series of films by Chris Pinto is his name, called The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, because I'm starting to get more and more interested in this character Francis Bacon and John Dee and their role in setting a esoteric, shall we call it, an occult agenda right at the very beginning of the foundation of the United States.
The movie National Treasure revealed to many the role of Freemasons in the founding of America. Often seen as a shadowy organization with hidden agendas, Masonry was portrayed in a positive light. Was this coincidence, or could there have been something behind it?
I think there's probably a little something behind it.
The Freemasons among our founding fathers left us clues like these. The unfinished pyramid, the all-seeing eye. They're speaking to us through these.
Well, the movie National Treasure is probably the first film in many years that has given a positive spin to the Masonic Lodge. And essentially, it seems to have been at least partially designed as kind of a propaganda piece for them.
They were basically trying to say that these people who have hidden this secret knowledge of whatever it was, the gold stash or whatever, the Masons, are basically good guys.
Because it makes them appear to be this sort of benign, shadowy group that's in the background protecting these important ancient secrets and also protecting this great, massive treasure.
It was fairly accurate in its Masonic elements.
You can tell whoever made the film either was a Mason, and of course there's a lot of Masons in Hollywood, or else had done a lot of research.
Screenwriter Jim Kauf, who developed the storyline for Disney Pictures, claims no Masonic connection. Yet some researchers are not convinced.
Masons were involved in the writing of that, it seems to me, because then they tried to turn it around and, you know, say that the Freemasonry is a good thing, that it has these hidden secrets deep within it, and that someday will be revealed and, you know, bring good things to America, etc.
Yet did the filmmakers accurately portray the real secrets of Masonry?
The thing I think that's unfortunate about the movie is, other than it kind of glamorizes the Masons, is that it makes it sound like the treasure of Masonry is monetary, that it's this enormous cachet of wealth and gold and jewels and urns and statues and whatever. And really, that's not what the treasure of Masonry is. The treasure of Masonry is esoteric wisdom. It is what Masons believe. It is the secret of eternal life and immortality. And that's an entirely different thing.
Conspiracy theorists have suggested that the film was intended to mislead. But the question remains, if Masons were involved in the making of the film, what would motivate them to tell a story about a society sworn to secrecy?
I think Masons have been pretty desperate over the last couple decades. They've taken a lot of hits, due in at least part to my books, and their membership is declining fast. Men love secrets, and that's just a basic truism. And so if they advertise that through a popular movie, you know, maybe it would generate a little more interest.
On one level, the film, I think it does some good in that it does educate people about the origins of our country and the fact that the origins of our country was very much steeped in Masonry. But on the other hand, I think it misleads about the benign nature of Masonry's involvement. And also it misleads by defining the nature of what Masonry has been guarding for the last 3,000 years.
But what has Masonry been guarding for the last 3,000 years? The real history of the craft, as it is called, varies from one source to another, and is a continued thorn of controversy. Masons claim biblical origins dating back to Tubal Cain, the first craftsman, as well as Nimrod, who built the Tower of Babel and founded the ancient city of Babylon. King Solomon plays an important role, as Masons are said to have been the builders of the Great Temple in Jerusalem. No less important is the influence of Gnosticism, sometimes called the mother of Masonry. According to Masonic historian Albert Mackey, Gnosticism is where Masonry gets the mysterious letter G, as seen here in the midst of the Masonic square and compass, a symbol that often adorns Masonic tombstones. Known for rejecting the biblical gospels, the Gnostics claim to be the real Christians, an issue the apostles spoke vehemently against in the New Testament. The Gnostic Gospels have been promoted by writers like Elaine Pagels and celebrities such as Jane Fonda. It was the Gnostic teachings that formed the heart of Dan Brown's blockbuster book, The Da Vinci Code. The Gnostics were known to express a humanistic view of Christ, a view they are said to have exploited for the purpose of justifying their debauchery of women. Hence the tales of Jesus and his alleged relationship with Mary Magdalene, a view often attributed to the Gnostics and repeated in Brown's controversial book.
So that's Chris Pinto's part of his series. I think fascinating series. He is, I think, Christian Zionist. He seems to be a little bit pro-Israeli for my liking. But these are quite a while ago that he did these. And he's the actual series is called The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. And that is part... an excerpt from the first part, one of four parts, Francis Bacon, the New Atlantist, Making a Masonic Christ. So I'll put another link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Maybe we'll move on to the next one of his in future weeks, which is called Riddles in Stone, which is quite a... I remember watching that several years ago, be very impressed. Anyway, some poetry. We mustn't forget Patricia has sent us a lovely poem in this week. It's called Gangs, Clans, Plans and Scams. Of tentacles with grasp so tight, where Zionists schmooze day and night, to wrong our rights, to lie, deceive, false flags mount up as lies conceive, stories spinning, winning words, or of pity parties quite absurd. Days of awe with stick abuse to wear us down and then confuse, gold rope bound, red carpet walk of special faith that talks the talk. Apocalypse, see madmen bend, catastrophes, disaster trends, perverted words on death run spree from gospels make calamity. Old goats of bloat all near their end, care not a jot our world intend. Blow up, destroy, kill and maim. Such evil has no need for tame. Jesus spoke of truth and light, access to grace and equal rights in Christ as one before God stand. No preferential treatment grand of dignity, no scapegoat makers, no us or them or Muslim haters, neither Jew nor Greek or slave nor free. as one with God, shall always be. Lovely. Thanks, thanks, Patricia. She's, you know, what you're doing in a way is saying something I've been saying over the last week or so, which is looking at the Jerusalem as the centre for 2,000 years ago of Jesus's gospel spreading through the world. We've now got the satanic inversion of that, haven't we? We've got the evil empire spreading. It's opening from Jerusalem. At the moment, it's based in Tel Aviv, just about still. We've got the total opposite of what Jesus was doing. So a completely anti-Christian Pax Zionica. Note, she says, neither Jew nor Greek is a phrase from Galatians 3:28, where the Apostle Paul writes that in Christ, traditional social, ethnic and gender distinctions, that is Jew, Greek, slave, free, male or female, no longer define a person's spiritual standing or access to salvation. It signifies spiritual equality and unity, not the erasure of identity. Thanks for a little bit of a lesson from our pastor of the evening, Patrizia Opulenza. Thank you. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks also to our guest Donald Mack in the first half, also to Tim Crossland, we're rather privileged to have, from one of the founders of Defend Our Juries, and of course to David Halpin and our sound engineer Dave Berzanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 o'clock or so to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Best place to get it is on the app. If you haven't got that, good idea to do so. And as I've said a couple of weeks ago now, sometimes these apps, as they're loads of updates, best thing to do is just delete the whole thing and reinstall the rated version. Otherwise they can get quite big. Do please share interviews and story tips with me on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group, and on WhatsApp, and on my Facebook group page. You can also download this show and the full-length interviews, subscribe to my weekly newsletter, and donate or even set up a small monthly sub. Thank you if you've already done that. All at this show page, thisweek.org.uk. Not to be confused with the talkradio.org.uk stream. That will take you straight to the live stream, which runs 24/7 and what is it, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling X, of course, it's supposed to be called. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. We are streaming live from Bristol now on the Talk Radio stream at djplugradio.org.uk, in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, at holylandradio.com from West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. Think of others before yourself, and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
From Tehran, looking up at the sky, wondering how many drones are gonna pass us by. Another meaningless war, another theater of blood, while our mothers are weeping, burying the young in the mud. It ain't just here, it's the soldiers you send across. Just 18 years old, another devastating loss. Families fractured for a line drawn in the sand. I see the tears in my city, I see it grief in your land. Oh, body went when the youth are bleeding out on the street. Just the echo of boots and the tragic defeat. I got no respect for the suits sitting up on the hill, drafting up legislation that's a license to kill. You talk of freedom and justice, spreading the light, but all you spread is the terror in the dead of the night. Your politicians are puppets, strings pulled by the greed, selling weapons to anyone, ignoring the need. They sit in ivory towers completely out of touch, making billions on bombs while the world suffers so much. They're
let's talk about Trump, the man painted in gold. Tearing up the agreements, acting reckless and bold. Sanctions choking my people, couldn't get medicine in. Assassinated our general and you cheer for the win. You preach about morals, put the word on his back. But check the flight logs on Epstein, look at your tracks. Hanging out with the monsters, turning a blind eye while you tweet from your mansion and let innocents die. Your policies crushed us, tried to starve us to death. But our rent is still breathing, we still got.
Not you, America. It's the ones who lead you. Listen to my heart.
I don't hate the Americans who are living in fear. To the working class people trying to make ends meet. To the students protesting, marching out on the street. We are one and the same, just trying to survive. Just trying to keep our cultures and our families alive. I see you standing for justice, fighting the system of hate. It's your corrupt politicians that are stealing our fate. I say love to the citizens from coast to coast. You're victims of the same machine that hurts us the most. So I wrote this track to try to bridge the divide. To lay down the weapons, to swallow the pride. We don't need another missile, no more tactical strikes. We need conversations on what the future looks like. My purpose is peace, let the hostility cease. Let the eagles and lions finally sit at the feast. From the Persian Gulf straight to the American shore. Let our generation be the one that finishes war. Put the guns in the dirt, let the healing begin. Because if we keep shooting, then nobody will. Not for the leaders, but for the innocent souls, for the next in line.
Rising Star.